NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Monday to you. Thank you so much for tuning into another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, here on NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today in the midst of summer vacation, I think, for some folks. We've got John Pop, actually, behind the board here in Farmville, Virginia. I see Danny Lyon up there at the mothership. Is that a Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race pullover that you got on there, Danny? That's what I thought. Coming up this weekend, I recognize that. Recognize that logo, the Bat Bass logo. Speaking of, by the way, I think we've got a picture from Bristol. The Bat Bass crossing signs are up because this is race week. Coming up August 18th, Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race from the Bristol Motor Speedway. We are looking forward to seeing you there. You can still get your tickets, the cheapest place anywhere for NRA members, NRARaceTix.com. 15% off of any ticket there at the Speedway for NRA members. And it's going to be a fantastic weekend, so looking forward to it. John Pop and I were talking about that earlier today, as a matter of fact. And we'll have reports from Bristol coming up later on in the week. On the program this afternoon, our friend Selena Zito joins us, author of The Great Revolt, along with Brad Todd, talking about some of the stories of the day, including her latest column, Trump's Not the Reason the GOP Sputtered in Ohio, plus Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others joins us later on in the hour. The growing trend of police inaction, letting potential perpetrators get off easy. Is that really what's going on here? A trend of police inaction? Or is it, are we seeing more plea bargains handed down? Things of that nature. Piece of the New York Post. Growing trend of police inaction lets potential perps get off easy. A self-described schizophrenic threw a brick at his Washington Heights neighbor this week. Lunged at her with a knife. He was back in the street less than 24 hours after cops picked him up. See, by my mind, then, like, the police would actually be the cops not actually picking him up. A woman who targeted, or who was targeted by this guy, said, I was in shock. I didn't expect him to be released so quickly, so I hadn't prepared myself to see him again. This person threatened to kill me and lives in my building. I want to get him out of the building because I don't feel safe or comfortable with him living here. New York Post reports last week. Beyond the looming threat that the police inaction posed to her lies a more troubling trend, one that has become prevalent among New York Police Department rank and file under Mayor Bill de Blasio and his police commissioner in the last 2 years, James O'Neill. Last week, cops did virtually nothing about pervy Manhattan apartment doorman Jonathan Aviles, who texted female residents of the building where he worked anonymous photos of his junk, as well as creepy text messages, despite official complaints from four women in the building, at least not until the Post reported on the accused stalker and tracked him down. DA Mark Bettero says there certainly appears to be enough information to investigate further and consider criminal charges. So sounds like New York Post reporting on maybe some actual incidents where the police themselves are turning a blind eye, or at least just determining there's not enough evidence to make an arrest when maybe it seems there is. Once that arrest is made, however, you have other problems that will pop up. We'll talk about that in our deal of the day this afternoon. Also, next hour, Lucretia Hughes, Second Amendment activist, joins us. You may have seen her Freedom Safest Play spot running here on NRA TV. Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire in Woodland Park, New Jersey. Now, you know, each and every day on the program, we have our hero of the day. It's an armed citizen story. We have our deal of the day. A story from the criminal justice system being light on criminals. And then we have our good guy of the day, which is often, but not always, a member of law enforcement or a first responder who's in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, steps up. Maybe it's part of their job. Maybe it's not a part of their job, but they do something special. As I said, not always are these stories about first responders. And Anthony Calandro and the folks at the Gun for Hire Range in Woodland Park, New Jersey, they stepped up in a very big way to do something special. There was flash flooding there in Woodland Park, New Jersey over the weekend. And I guess other parts of New Jersey as well, where it was pretty bad. So not far from Gun for Hire, there's a dog grooming slash boarding facility, doggy daycare, basically. And the floodwaters were actually entering the kennels, entering where the dogs were. There are about 80 dogs that had to get rescued. And you know who did it? The folks from Gun for Hire. Even putting the dogs up overnight in some cases at the range. It's a great story. And Anthony, you know, was just honored, just named NRA ILA's 2017 Volunteer of the Year. And we've talked with Anthony before about what it's like owning and operating a range 15 miles from New York City in North Jersey. Some of you would think some of the most anti-gun real estate in the country. And yet there's Anthony expanding his facility with the approval of local town leaders. There is Anthony becoming a part of that community. And I saw a news report on Gun for Hire and what these folks did. And the owner of this doggy daycare, who I don't know if he's pro-gun or anti-gun, but odds are in North Jersey, guy's probably not a huge Second Amendment supporter. He was just so happy at what Anthony and the staff there at Gun for Hire had done. And he said, you know, and I talked to Anthony and I told him, if there's anything we can ever do for you, you just let us know. That's part of who gun owners are, I think, around the country. We're good neighbors. But Anthony Calandra is certainly demonstrating that there. So he's going to join us. A special good guy segment. But we will also have another good guy for you coming up at the top of Hour 3, along with our hero of the day, our deal of the day. Andrew Langer joins us from the Institute for Liberty in Hour 3 as well, talking about that study showing professors are less likely to want to hire NRA members or Republicans, NRA members in particular. That's about the worst you could be if you are a prospective hire in academia. If your fellow or would-be fellow professors find out that you're an NRA member, that's the one that's going to make them really decide to come down against hiring you. Republicans like a close second. The anti-gun bias is real. And we'll talk about it with Andrew Langer coming up in Hour 3. Also in Hour 3, Dave Koppel, Research Director at the Independence Institute, who has a piece at the Volokh Conspiracy on the 1986 plastic gun panic. That's right. All of the panic and the freakouts over 3D printed firearms that were are still taking place, by the way. You're still seeing legislation introduced at the state level, at the congressional level. Got to ban this. Got to ban the files, got to ban whatever. Just don't even mention it. May have to ban 3D printers. May just have to go ahead and ban plastic because we're already banning the straws too. But the panic itself is not really new. This is a tool in the toolbox of gun control advocates. And ironically enough, you know, gun control advocates proclaim all the time that gun owners and the gun lobby exists and is propelled by fear, right? Well, the only reason you guys are successful is because you scare everybody and don't own a gun, because if you don't own a gun, you're a victim of a criminal, then you're just going to be hurt. So the best way to avoid that is just own a gun. You just want people afraid. You want people afraid. That's their argument. You know who really wants people afraid? The anti-gun activists. Because they're really talking to, for the most part, Americans who don't own firearms. They're not gun owners. Now, the gun control groups could try to educate those folks if they really wanted to, but as we know, they don't. It's much easier to scare them. You get their emotions wrapped up in the issue, and we know the gun control advocates like to do that. Don't talk about the facts, don't talk about specifics, and certainly don't call it gun control. But scare people, freak people out, and use that as a motivating factor to try to get them to sign up for a mailing list or to sign a petition, which amounts to signing up for a mailing list. Get them to donate, maybe get them to put on a T-shirt and go to a city council meeting. But what they're using to try to increase their activism is fear. Right now, again, it's the fear of being able to print off a plastic gun from a 3D printer. But if it's not that, or when that loses its effectiveness as a fear-mongering tactic, there'll be something else. There always is. Even when violent crime is dropping, when millions of Americans are protecting themselves legally and lawfully outside of their home, thanks to their concealed carry license, or thanks to living in a state that's constitutional carry, there's always something for the gun control advocates to try to scare Americans about. Right now, again, this week, it's 3D plastic guns. And as Dave Goble said 30 years ago, it was plastic guns. So we'll talk about that in Hour 3. And, of course, we have the day's latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the country, including some news in terms of elections. Also, we told you about this on Friday. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings have been set now for September the 4th. And, you know, this is just bizarre. So a couple of weeks ago we were talking about, and I think it might have been with either Derek Hunter or it may have been Andrew Langer, about Brett Kavanaugh's wife, who seems like a lovely lady, was the town manager, worked in town government for Chevy Chase, Maryland. I think it was Chevy Chase. And New York Times and Associated Press filed Freedom of Information Act requests wanting emails. I think New York Times wanted every email that Brett Kavanaugh's wife had sent as a town official. AP had asked, I think, for some selected terms, including, like, you know, federalist and conservative, things like that. Why? I mean, she's not been nominated for anything because they're fishing. They're looking for something. And as we get closer to September the 4th and maybe a vote in late September, early October to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, those who are opposed to this nomination, those who don't want to see him confirmed, are starting to panic a little bit, I think. You know, already you've seen some of these red state Democrats like Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly. I think even Claire McCaskill said, you know, yep, we'll go ahead and we'll meet with Brett Kavanaugh. At the same time, you know, again, the hard left Democrat base is freaking out, saying don't even show up for work. Just stay out of the Senate floor and then we'll just make everything grind to a halt and then we can delay the proceedings because that's our hope. So they're panicking a little bit. Press two. There's a tweet by ProPublica, which is a nonprofit news outlet. I think we've got this tweet. This was sent out earlier today, I believe. And it has to do with Brett Kavanaugh and the Washington Nationals. Yeah, because Brett Kavanaugh, he was a season ticket holder. And as it turns out, apparently he bought some season tickets with friends. There was some consternation a few weeks ago about him taking out, going into debt, basically putting these season tickets on a credit card and then getting paid back later and paying it off. And there was, well, why was there just these huge charges here for baseball tickets? Because he went in with friends and put it on his card and they paid him back. So ProPublica, do we have this tweet, Justin? Let me know if we don't have it, but I think we've got it. There we go. ProPublica sends this out. Today, did you attend a Washington Nationals game in 2017? You might be able to help us, really. There's the graphic. Did you take a photo of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh at a Washington Nationals game? ProPublica would love to see it. Send tips to supremecourt@propublica.org. And why do they want pictures of Brett Kavanaugh at a Washington Nationals game? I mean, it seems kind of, because they want to see who he went with. They want to see if he was sitting next to somebody newsworthy, maybe scandalous. And so they're asking people who just happened to go to Washington National games last year, go through your pictures, pull out your phone, go through those pictures, zoom in as much as you can and look for those faces in the crowd. See if you find one that looks like Brett Kavanaugh. And if you did, send those pictures to us. Why? Why? I mean, that's amazing. Here's somebody who's been nominated to the Supreme Court, and ProPublica apparently doesn't want to talk to, you know, the folks who've clerked for him, because I think they've all come out in support of him. ProPublica isn't asking anybody who, you know, worked in the D.C. Court of Appeals to come tell us a story. No, they're asking people, if you went to a baseball game and you think you may have inadvertently snapped a picture of some guy that turns out to be a judge in D.C. who's now been nominated to the Supreme Court, send us that picture, please. I mean, this isn't journalism. This is looks suspiciously like a witch hunt. And again, we've got a few weeks left before the confirmation hearings begin. A few more weeks after that until a vote takes place. And I imagine we have not actually seen the media hit rock bottom yet. But they're getting there. All right, stick around. When we come back after a quick timeout, Selena Zito joins us, co-author of The Great Revolt, Washington Examiner, and New York Post columnist as well. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Four liberals on the Supreme Court would take away your right to self-defense.
What does the Second Amendment mean to you?
It's not the right of an individual to keep a gun next to his bed.
Four liberal justices oppose your right to self-defense. Four justices support your right to self-defense. President Trump chose Brett Kavanaugh to break the tie. Your right to self-defense depends on this vote. Tell your senator, defend our right to self-defense. Confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children. And freedom's safest place.
Speaking with Cole McCullough with the NRA Competitive Shooting Division. Cole, welcome back to the program. Lots of things happening at the NRA Competitive Shooting Division. What's going on?
Absolutely. We've taken the last year or so to begin to really rebuild the Competition Shooting Division in a lot of ways and to prepare for our national matches at Camp Atterbury, Indiana, for a high power and back to Camp Perry for pistol and for Bianchi Cup and our World Action Pistol Championship, which is coming up in a few weeks.
Cole, I don't know how you do it, man. How do you keep all this straight? Your competitive shooting division at NRA is involved in so many things. It's give people an idea what y'all do.
Right. I mean, there's over 12,000 sanctioned NRA matches every year. That's a huge number in itself. But when you combine it about 19 different disciplines of shooting, you really have an awful lot of things. That doesn't even count the ones that NRA supports that we don't run.
And you mentioned some of the big ones. Camp Atterbury, Camp Perry for pistol, there's Bianchi. But the competitive shooting division is for everybody, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a great way. There's depends upon what type of shooting you like to do, whether it's small bore or high power precision pistol or even action pistol shooting. There's a lot of different things and a lot of different ways you can get into competitive shooting.
And people think about the more traditional, but you talk about action and three-gun. There's lots of new, neat things happening in competitive shooting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's just, for example, the Daisy has a big match that's coming up where kids from all over the country come in and have teams. NRA is going to be there representing that. There's national muzzle loading championships that are coming up. There's over 1,000 shooters that come to that. NRA supports that. There's just an awful lot of different ways that people can be involved in competitive shooting, and it's stuff that you can do.
It's really cool. It spans the generations.
Indeed. It spans every good type of responsible gun-owning citizen, and that's what the NRA is all about.
How do we get more information?
You can just go to, you can Google the NRA Competitive Shooting Division online, and it'll take you right to the website and find all that.
Cole McCullough, NRA Competitive Shooting Division, something for everyone there, so check them out, and thank you for what you do every day. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is where it all begins, at the Last Great Coliseum, the Bristol Motor Speedway, on August 18, 2018. This is where the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race will be kicking off. Behind me and all around us, these stands are going to be filled with screaming, cheering race fans, NRA members, folks who love this country, and you've got to be a part of this. There's not a bad seat in the house at the Bristol Motor Speedway. It's one of the things I love about this place. First of all, look at the view beyond the track from up here, the mountains in the distance. And those hills right there closer to the track, they're going to be filled with folks who are camping, who've been here all week long as part of race week. And then Again, you can't get any higher than where we are right now at the Bristol Motor Speedway, but if you look down, it's like you are on top of this track. Imagine 40 cars bumper to bumper jostling for position right there, and it's like you're watching it from right on top of the action. Now, if you wait for this checkered flag to wave, you're going to be too late to get your tickets to the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. So you want to go ahead and you want to go to NRARaceTix.com now. You are going to get the lowest price for race tickets anywhere you can find it. 15% off for NRA members, any seat in the house, NRARaceTix.com. And when you get here to the Bristol Motor Speedway, there's all kinds of stuff to see and do, but make sure you actually come inside the Bruton Smith building. Make sure you shop here and get all of your cool merchandise for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. You've got stickers. You've got hats. You know I'm a big fan of hats, right? We've got koozies. We've got all kinds of great stuff. And really, the best thing that you're going to find here is the experience itself. There is nothing like the night race at the Last Great Coliseum. It's August 18th, 2018. We will see you in Bristol, baby, for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. Welcome back to Cam and Company. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia. And I got to say, it's pretty nice out for mid-August. Not blazingly hot. It's not 90% humidity. It's a hint of fall in the air. Maybe my favorite time of year here in Central Virginia. It's a good time of year, I think, around the country, even in places like Eastern Ohio or even around Columbus. So Selena Zito joins us from Great Revolt fame, Examiner, yeah. Washington Examiner, New York Post. Selena, how are you today?
I'm swell. How are you? I don't know about you, but we have had beautiful days, but it seems like every day there's some kind of crazy thunderstorm that comes through with, like, crazy flash flooding.
We haven't really had the flash flooding, but we have had those afternoon storms. I mean, we're actually going to talk with the guy next hour, Anthony Calandro, who's in Woodland Park, New Jersey, and he's got a gun range there. They ended up having to rescue, like, 80 dogs from a nearby business because there were such bad flash floods. Like 15 miles outside of New York over the weekend. I mean, it was crazy.
We've had so many flash floods just in my neighborhood alone, let alone our region. It's really been a very interesting year for that.
Well, you know, Selena, if you'd quit using straws, that would all come to an end, apparently.
That's true.
It's all your fault. Yeah, you've got a piece of the New York Post right now. Trump's not the reason the GOP sputtered in Ohio, much like your straw use is not the reason for flash flooding. And you say last week Troy Balderson, the Republican, struggled to beat Danny O'Connor in this special election. I think it was the 12th district. Still too close to call. Troy Balderson has declared victory, but you still got about, I guess you've got about 5,000 or 6,000 votes, absentee ballots, provisional ballots that have yet to be counted. So August 24th is when we'll actually see this election certified. This is a congressional seat that's been held by Republicans, I think, since 1982, something like that.
Yeah.
Right, a really long time. It went for Donald Trump by 11 points, you say, 2 years ago. So what's going on? I mean, we talked about this a little bit because you were in this district on election night. And why do you think this race was as and is as close as it turned out to be?
Well, first of all, I want to really stress this point, and I know I've said this 1,000 times on your show. Special elections are just that. They're special. They are not an indicator of what's going to happen in the fall midterms. And here's why. Think about 2006 when the Democrats, you know, rushed over the Republicans and took 30 seats from their majority. In every single special election that summer before the midterms, the Democrats lost every special election. 2010, the Republicans lost all 7 special elections and won 63 seats in that midterm election. Mm-hmm. So I'm always, you know, there's hints of what's going on, but I don't think that there's actual indicators. I mean, you know, like, this is what's going to happen, kind of declarative statement. So I wrote this in May, a very similar column to this one that I wrote in August, in that the Republicans have a terrible message. Their message is not good. It's not connecting. Part of the problem is the people that that they create these messages don't necessarily live and work and pray and conduct their lives in these districts. Another reason is this is a new coalition of voters. And I don't think a lot of the people that are making the messaging quite understand who they are. And a lot of them also didn't like Trump. I mean, there's a lot of establishment message makers in Washington who did not like Trump. Therefore, it's very difficult for them to understand who they're supposed to be appealing to. Now, you got to give the Democrats credit. With both Conor Lamb and Danny O'Connor, they picked candidates who knew how to and understood how to talk about local issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's like infrastructure, veterans affairs, the importance of keeping unions strong. Good key tenements to appealing to both, like both parts of this coalition. And the Republicans were like, Nancy Pelosi's bad. The world is ending. She comes back. I mean, I think that's already been established.
Well,
you need to talk about what you're good at. You need an aspirational message. That's what drew people towards Trump. And that's what should always draw voters towards the Republican Party.
So a couple of points there that I want to key on. So it's interesting you talk about Conor Lamb and Danny O'Connor, because in terms of Second Amendment issues, you know, it's funny, Celine. I mean, like, you can't turn around these days without tripping over a think piece on how this is the year Democrats are running on gun control. And certainly there are some who are doing exactly that. But I would note that Conor Lamb actually had an ad where he was shooting an AR-15. And said, I'm not going to ban this gun. Danny O'Connor, I went to his website. He was endorsed by Moms Demand Action. You couldn't find that on his campaign website. You could find no mention whatsoever of firearms one way or the other. He says, I'm not touching it. Right. As you said, it was a lot about infrastructure. It was about these bread and butter issues. And you talk about, the aspirational message. It's interesting. I mean, people wonder why, there's this Gallup poll that came out today showing, I think, Americans, Democrats now have a more positive view of socialism than capitalism, which has been the case for a couple of years. But now socialism has now cracked 50% among 18 to 29 year olds. That's where the love of socialism comes. And look, I think socialism's silly. I think it's a nightmare scenario for any country that enacts it. But it has an aspirational message, Selena. That's all it has, frankly, is that aspirational message of, we can just tax the rich and you can have all this stuff that you want, right? All of your problems will be solved. I mean, it's a very simple aspirational message of the rich can pay for everything in your life, but it's an aspirational message. And
well, that is true.
Right? And if it's not met with any sort of aspirational message, then maybe the bad aspirational message wins out. And I think that you're right. You do need to be able to speak to the electorate where they are. This is something that you've actually written about quite a bit over the last couple of years. In a lot of these places like Eastern Ohio, fears and concerns about automation. And what does it mean when the physical plant may still remain, but instead of employing 400 people, now it's employing 200. And maybe, 5 years from now, it's going to employ 100 people. And for those people, it'll be, a good job, but there aren't going to be as many of those jobs going around. What do we do there? I think there's a great deal of concern from a lot of Americans about how do we navigate this world that we're living in right now? How do we find those good jobs? How do we make sure that it's not just places like San Francisco and New York where, it seems to be completely unaffordable to live, that are the big drivers of job growth? And these are all issues, like you say, that frankly Republicans can and should be able to talk to voters about.
Absolutely. They have to be able to. And I think that's why a key sort of part of a campaign should be about education. How do we educate young people to keep the high technology jobs here for those who are inclined or have the talent, keep these kids home, right? Like, say, Columbus. So, a great message that Balderson could have had was, look, I want to go to Washington and I want to work with other members of Congress and work with the president on how high technology jobs can keep your kids that are going to Ohio State living not far from home. They're coming back, and we don't have a great brain drain. Conversely, talk about how Votex goals are really important for students who live in the rural and exurban or in the blue-collar patches of that district, and how there's so many careers within the Votex Gold that can keep your students, your family, intact, keeping your kids living near you because they'd be able to be trained for jobs in the future. Like, those are really good things to talk about. And there really wasn't much of that. But, you know, these are easy messages to do. And I think they need to get out of the cookie-cutter messaging that comes from Washington. Look, as I said in the column, Donald Trump, like him, hate him, or indifferent, he is the sun of in American politics, and the rest of us are the solar system, just sort of twirling around it. And what he does and says impacts everything. And so you have to be able to have conversations about other things than Donald Trump to be able to, reach out to these different constituencies and tell them that you have the right ideas and tools to be effective in Washington.
Talking again with Selena Zito, co-author of The Great Revolt. Now, you know, Selena, you alluded to this new coalition of voters, which you and Brad Todd write a lot about. I mean, that basically is what The Great Revolt is about, that coalition of voters for Trump. And as you say, look, a lot of those folks, like, Trump was the first person they voted for since Ross Perot, right? They just don't vote. I mean, you have a whole chapter in there about the non-voters who voted for Donald Trump. Those are obviously not going to be a reliable part of any, you know, midterm voter outreach. But if you're a candidate out there in Ohio or in Western Pennsylvania, how do you target those people who voted for the first time maybe in, you know, 20 plus years back in 2016, have no plans of voting this year? How do you motivate them to actually get out and go and vote on Election Day?
Well, it's really easy. You speak directly to those voters, and that's by speaking to all the voters, but you speak directly to them and you say, look, I know you took a chance with this guy. Some of you, didn't like him or were unsure. Some of you haven't voted for a very long time. But if you want him to be able to accomplish the things that he needs to accomplish, he needs a Republican Congress to be able to do that. It's really that simple. And he needs you just as much, if not more, than he needed you in November of 2016.
That makes sense to me. Now, now on the Democratic side of the aisle, you know, so here we talked about the affirmational message for Republicans. There's obviously going to be also a lot of negative campaigning on the left and the right. Impeach Trump coming from the left. Don't vote for, you know, Nancy Pelosi on the right. But I'm curious, you know, we were talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and. You know, last week in the primaries held across the nation, it was not a good week for the Democratic Socialists, Selena. Places like Kansas 3rd District did not elect the candidate that was favored by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is that moment, you think, passing? Is the media, frankly, who I think in many cases are allies of the Democratic Party, are they starting to realize, okay, you know what, ixnay on the socialism stuff, because if we keep talking about it, it's just going to make it really easier to brand all of us as socialists, and that doesn't play well in large parts of America. So let's tamp down on all of this socialism talk.
So I think two competing things happened here. First of all, like always, my profession elevated someone who won in a specific district to a place of stardom because we're always looking for the next star. We're always looking for the next it person, it guy, it girl, whatever it may be. The thing that sort of, you know, is the flame that everybody wants to turn into. So I don't think that was particularly good for her. Having said that, I'd be really cautious about if I was a Democrat or a Republican and say, oh, thank God we kind of dodged that bullet. It looks like it's dying off. Well, you know what? I will go back to what I said earlier about the midterms in 2010 when all those Tea Party candidates lost in those special elections. Tea Party didn't go away. And so, you know, everyone, and I mean, I can remember reading story after story after story of the Tea Party means nothing. Now, the Tea Party and DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, completely different things. But just because they had a bad primary night, and they may have a series of bad primary nights, doesn't mean that that energy and that sentiment isn't there. I mean, there were four seats in Pennsylvania in May held by moderate Democrat males who held all those seats for a very, very long time and were very good public servants who all were upended by female DSA-backed candidates in the Democratic primary. I mean, these are small little areas in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia in particular. So I'm very cautious to think just because they had a bad, you know, somewhat Super Tuesday, because they also lost in Michigan as well, does not mean I think it would be foolhardy to say it's over, because I see too much energy from these voters, and I think that the Democrats quite honestly want you to believe that it's over. But I don't think it's over. I mean, Democrats don't want this. I mean, if these people will come out and vote for their guy in general, yay. But if they get their candidates in through primaries over a more traditional Democrat, they're going to be horrified.
Selena, always a good time talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Unfortunately, we've got to take a time out. But I appreciate your time and hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Selena Zito with us here on Cam and Company. Make sure you're following Selena on Twitter at Selena Zito. We've got Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others going to join us here in just a minute or two. We'll talk about police in action, perhaps, in New York City, as well as supposedly the anti-white supremacist marches in Charlottesville and Washington, D.C. that kind of turned into anti-police marches, sounds like, over the weekend, because I guess there are more police than there were racists there, so you had to yell at somebody. But we'll talk about this with Rob O'Donnell after a quick timeout as well. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company still to come.
Speaking with Eric Lipp with NRA Community Outreach, you've hit another milestone. Tell us what's going on.
We've reached a huge milestone. Actually had the best month of Eddie Eagle history last month. As far as the number of materials sent out to people requesting, that's going to be law enforcement and educators, daycares, libraries, hospitals, all the folks that we work hand in hand with to try to get materials to for their children and their communities whenever they need them.
They must be keeping you happy, Eric. It's a great problem to have. The biggest month in the history of the program. Wow. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
What do you have any idea why? I mean, it's great the program continues to grow. What do you think happened here? Is a sudden spike? It's not a sudden spike in interest, but it's been growing and growing. It's great stuff.
That's right. You know, we've had a tremendous success partnering with law enforcement, and, you know, we start talking with them and marketing to those folks here when school gets out. You know, they have a lot of kids that get out of school and have time on their hands, and they take that time to try to teach things to their community. And safety is one of the important things involved with community policing. We try to work with them, supply those needs, everything from events during 4th of July. To other safety events, to, you know, just coming up, this happened this past week was National Night Out, is a huge community event, and combine those all together and you get a lot of folks that have a lot of events going on during the summer. So most of the folks that order from us are repeat orders. You know, they know what we have, they love our program, they think it helps keeps their communities safe, and they call us every year around this time, and, you know, they tell their friends, and they tell their friends, and, you know, word of mouth gets out there with a great product that has great availability. And like I said, safety is our number one priority, and that's what they're about also. So we work together, get that stuff to their needs, and they get it to their communities.
So, Eric, it's great to see this wonderful partnership between law enforcement and other organizations with you and Community Outreach, with Eddie Eagle specifically, but also in general. The NRA has traditionally had a great relationship and partnership with law enforcement on so many different levels. So it's great to see that, you know, how law enforcement has embraced the program. So let's take a step back for a minute, Eric, to tell folks who don't know, what is the Eddie Eagle, the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program? What's it all about?
Absolutely. Well, I could just say it's all about safety first and foremost, but it's a firearm accident prevention for young children, pre-K through fourth grade, and everything centers around one easy, simple message, and that's if you come across a firearm, to stop, don't touch, run away, and tell a grown-up. It's a very simple safety message, something that we've done a lot of research and testing on, and something that kids can remember. And that's what's important when you come to these situations. And our partners agree, whether it's teachers, law enforcement, or even parents, we hear great things back from them and say that, hey, this message does work. My child does watch your, you know, that Eagle video or goes through our materials and they remember it. We talk to law enforcement that, you know, not only do they remember, hey, what time of year is that we need to get materials for our kids, but the kids themselves remember it. They might start in first grade, and by third grade, they know that Eddie Eagle is coming as well, and they're excited. They remember the message, and, you know, that's why we're out here doing what we do.
So great. And you guys have great online resources, tools. You mentioned videos. There's materials. There's stuff for kids. There's stuff for parents at you know, virtually. But I'll tell you, the greatest thing, and I've witnessed this a number of times myself, Eric, is to see when Eddie goes out in the community and goes to a school or goes to another organization. It's so much fun, so positive, and there's such great energy in the room whenever Eddie shows up. So that is a huge part of it as well. So, Eric, you know, it's the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. So some folks are going to think, well, why would I want to endorse or use a gun safe program that's coming from the NRA? What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, we're the only folks that do it, quite frankly. We've been around for 30 years now. Other people might say they have solutions, but they don't have anything for in hand, per se. Like you said, we have materials that are downloadable online, a video that's watchable online for parents and folks that want to do it themselves. And then just like we mentioned last month, we sent over 225,000 actual workbooks out to law enforcement. We have four different level of workbooks from pre-K kindergarten level all the way up to third and fourth grade level. So we're trying to cover all their bases and take care of them in any way we can. So that's, like I said, from print materials all the way to online stuff. And you know, trying to get materials to the parents. That's our number one goal, is trying to keep kids safe.
How can folks get more information about Eddie Eagle?
The easiest way is to go on our website. It's real simple, www.eddieeagle.com. That's where you'll find the home base for your kids so they can watch the movie there. Look at our workbooks. We have different lessons, plans, sing-alongs. And then in the top left corner, you'll see a tab that says grown-ups, and that'll take you to our other site, give you information about how to print off print materials, also how to talk to other parents as a firearm owner or a non-firearm owner. If you have children, it might be a topic that you might want to discuss with your neighbors or other people that you work with or live with. So we give information on that as well.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Coming up an hour from now, Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire in Woodland Park, New Jersey. Right now, we want to welcome to the program from Brothers Before Others, Mr. Rob O'Donnell is with us on the show. Rob, how are you, sir?
Doing very well today, Cam. Back from vacation, ready to go.
Excellent. I hope that vacation treated you well. Sorry about the long car drive back, but glad that you're with us. And so a couple of things I want to talk with you about. The New York Post has this piece talking about the, quote, growing trend of police inaction, letting potential perps get off easy. One of the stories they talk about was this self-described schizophrenic who threw a brick at his neighbor in Washington Heights this week, lunged at her with a knife, yet was back on the streets less than 24 hours after cops picked him up. To me, that's less of police inaction and maybe more of what happens, you know, within the system itself. But the Post lays out a couple of other cases, one about an apartment doorman named Jonathan Aviles, who was texting residents of the building where he worked, pictures of his junk, creepy text messages. Post ends up reporting this stalker, tracks him down. Manhattan assistant DA Mark Bedero says there certainly appears to be enough information to investigate further and consider criminal charges. They say in another instance of police apparently turning a blind eye, a panicked Brooklyn mom who went to her local precinct days ago to report her 9-year-old son and 12-year-old daughter missing was sent away, told by the desk officer to go home and call 911. That officer has since been placed on modified duty. Police source said of the officers involved in all three cases, they're not doing their job. These cops are bleeping lazy. 95% of police officers just get their checks. I'm curious what your take is on statements like that, talking about the NYPD, Rob.
Well, I'll start off with the cases. As far as the doorman who was texting female members in his building, that's a clear-cut case of aggravated harassment. It's a charge we deal with. I dealt with as a detective, you know, dozens of times a week, you know, a boyfriend or girlfriend calling and making threats over the phone, sending threatening text messages. It's aggravated harassment in the second degree. It's a Class B misdemeanor. There's really no excuse for not following up with that. The text messages, the tracing of it, so I don't know the backstory with that. As far as the woman with her children to the precinct, you always refer the complaint, not the complainant. So that's why I would imagine that desk officer was modified. He didn't follow procedure. There's no reason to send that person back to their home. You can take the report there. But what the backstory is, you know, how many times has she reported her kids missing? Is this an ongoing issue where, you know, the desk officer is aware of her and their situation, and it's an ongoing problematic issue? Again, there's a backstory to everything. As far as the mental health issue with the person throwing the brick, again, the police have become the mental health experts, the teachers, the psychiatrists, the doctors of the world now. So, you know, it sounds like the police took this individual into custody, brought him to a hospital, and the hospital released him within 24 hours to where he was, again, schizophrenic when the family confronted him at the door and displayed the same behavior. So, again, I would think that's a failure of the mental health system. How come they didn't refer him to jail, you know, at that point, or how come they didn't keep him in a mental health facility until they can clear him? Obviously, he was being affected by the same things. As far as the police being lazy, in America, go ahead.
No, I was finish your thought, Rob, please.
As far as the police in America being lazy, police in America are caught in a purgatory. You know, there's no good or bad for them. With the politicians today, you know, if they take inaction, like you saw in Chicago with the gentleman jumping on the hood of the police car, they're bad. If they take action where they would have grabbed him off the hood, you know, he was jumping on the hood of police car. If they would have put their hands on him, he would have resisted. There were cameras all around. They would have caught him resisting. They would have caught police using necessary force to bring him in under control. They would have been bad in the eyes of the media and the public in that community. You could have had riots again, depending on how it went that out. So there's no right or wrong for police right now. They're caught in this purgatory of policing that leaves them without action, for lack of a better word. I mean, I think they should be doing their job. The letter of the law is there. Follow it. But without the police leaders and the elected officials in a community that's going to back them when they do take these actions, How are we supposed to look at them and say, why didn't you, when they're just being left out to dry if there's no right or wrong?
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, that same anonymous police source who told the New York Post that these cops are bleeping lazy, he went on to say, you know, the police commissioner doesn't have your back and the mayor definitely doesn't have your back. It's bad. It's really bad. It's bad. Which makes me wonder, is it really laziness that he's talking about, or is it – you know, just the lack of morale, as you describe, you know, knowing that the politicians are there to throw you under the bus, that everything you do is liable to be second guessed. The media is certainly going to help the court of public opinion judge you instantly. And while at the same time, you know, if, you do, let's say, use your firearm in the commission, you know, of your official duties, that process, that legal process, the real process is going to drag out and take time, and you're not going to be able to say anything. You know, you talk about that catch-22 situation that a lot of these officers find themselves in, and I think a lot of that, not all of it certainly, but a lot of that could be alleviated if these officers felt like, you know what, we've got a mayor who's going to stand behind the force. We've got a chief who's not going to throw us under the bus. And certainly, as you say, there are cops that aren't doing their job, if there are cops that are breaking the law, it's got to come down like a hammer on them. But, you know, over the weekend, Rob, and this is maybe a good segue, in Charlottesville and Washington, D.C., we saw these protests that were supposed to be against, you know, white nationalists turn into attacks on law enforcement, where, you know, a lot of these folks were saying there's no difference between the KKK and your local police force, that that these are these police officers are, you know, tools of oppression. And, you know, again, I haven't seen the mayor of Washington, D.C. I haven't seen the mayor of Charlottesville speak up and condemn those comments. I assume that they do, and maybe they will quietly. But, you know, this anti-cop attitude, it's not like it, you know, just came out of nowhere. And you do get the sense that a lot of these politicians are actually playing to those protesters rather than having the backs of the men and women that are out there serving and protecting their communities each and every day.
Oh, they absolutely are playing that. You know, don't get me wrong. Police should be second-guessed. Police should always be second-guessed. Their actions should be looked at and scrutinized. But when they act accordingly, they act within policy, and the facts are on their side, there should be a full frontal support of their actions, their department, their policing. Hey, they did the right thing, calling out the mainstream media saying, no, you were wrong in this situation. You put out details before the facts came out, and you exasperated the problem. Police want to do a good job. Police became police officers to protect and serve. They need to go out. They need to know they have the support of those above them, those elected officials who sign their paychecks, that when I put my life on the line, when I stand between a citizen in danger and I do the right thing, my back is covered. I will be supported. That's gone this day and age. Look at Chicago. Look at New York. Look at these areas, St. Louis, that it's just destroyed because they're leaving these officers in this policing purgatory where there's no right or wrong for them. If they do the right thing, they'll be demonized because it'll be portrayed that they look at how aggressive the police are. If they don't do anything, they're demonized because they're saying they just want to collect their paycheck. They're not doing anything. They just come to work to show up.
Rob O'Donnell with the Brothers Before Others. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program as always, sir. Thank you so much, and hopefully get a chance to see you soon.
Sounds great, Cam.
All right, thank you, sir. Rob O'Donnell with us here on Cam and Company. Next hour, Lucretia Hughes going to join us. Also, Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire. Top of hour three, we have today's hero of the day. Deal of the day, good guy as well. Over the weekend, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, how a misfired gun-related tweet put Abrams on the defensive. Stacey Abrams, who is the Democrat running for governor in Georgia. And apparently over the weekend, there was a Moms Demand Action Gun Sense University conference in Georgia. And Shanna Watts was there. And Shanna Watts was tweeting. I didn't see this because Shanna Watts has blocked me, like she has blocked a sizable portion of people on Twitter. So I did not see this, but I'm relying on the reporting of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And they say the group's founder, Shanna Watts, Moms Man Action, Shanna Watts, tweeted that Stacey Abrams told the crowd there at this Gun Sense University conference, quote, "We're not going to allow guns for anyone, anywhere, anytime." Which sounds about right. No guns for anyone, anywhere, anytime. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says gun rights advocates quickly amplified that Saturday tweet, which was soon deleted, to energize voters who are critical of Abrams' support for gun control measures. Memes soon sprouted, asserting that the Democrat wants to ban guns, quote, in any place at any time. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says her actual comments, though, were far different than what Watts misquoted. I love it when the press just covers for the gun control groups. Let me tell you what Shanna Watts meant to say. When do you ever see that? When anybody on the right tweets out something that could be taken the wrong way. When is it? Let me tell you what Ben Shapiro actually meant to say. No. Bring out the mobs and pitchforks here. Right? It's just unbelievable. So here her actual comments were far different than what Watts misquoted. Here's what she told the group, according to audio of the 11-minute address obtained by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Quote, there are those of us who are told that our paths are going to be blocked by barriers that are created by folks, not ourselves. That because we are women, because we are people of color, because we are poor, because we believe that the right to bear arms does not mean the right to bear arms everywhere, anytime, anywhere. We are told that our beliefs are permanently off the table. Frankly, I'm not sure what exactly that statement means other than, but let's focus in on the right to bear arms does not mean the right to bear arms everywhere, anytime, anywhere. Which is a line that Shannon Watts herself has used. The problem is that the gun control advocates really, they're more in line with what Shannon Watts actually tweeted. They really don't believe in gun ownership for anyone, anywhere, or at any time. Because their idea of gun safety is don't own a gun. It's what we call a tell there. All right, that music means we've got to scoot for a couple of minutes. When we return, hour two of Cam and Company, more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information straight ahead. So stick around. We'll be right back with more. We're talking with Bill Romanelli, spokesman for Project Child Safe. And Bill, it's good to speak with you today.
Thanks for joining us. It's good to be here.
You bet. Project Child Safe, I mean, it's been around for a while, but for folks who have not heard of this program, and they've been living under a rock somewhere, what is Project Child Safe all about?
Sure. It was started in 1999 by the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and it's a firearm safety education program that works on two fronts. First is just getting tools and information out to people about storing guns safely, firearm safety in general. The real emphasis is on storing firearms responsibly when they're not in use. And then to make that happen, they put their money where their mouth is, and they provide free gun locks to law enforcement agencies all over the country to hand out in their communities. 38 million locks and counting so far.
That is amazing. And do you have any idea what the impact of this has been around the country?
Well, there was a report just issued by the National Safety Council that said fatal firearms accidents had dropped to their lowest level since record-keeping began. That's huge. And then there was recently a GAO report that also said that doing programs like this, making free gun locks available, actually does change behavior and people store firearms more responsibly. So nobody else can take more credit for that than NSSF for making that happen.
Yeah, and you know, again, I mean, as you say, there's a whole variety of things that goes into seeing those numbers go down. There's not just one cause, but every aspect that actually is effective, you know, can help us bring these numbers down even more. I mean, we're at historically low levels of accidental injuries and deaths involving firearms. I think that's a fantastic thing. I mean, I don't know about, you know, our opponents here, but I think it's a good thing that we have a safer society.
Absolutely, and we'd like to see the trend keep going in the right direction, for sure. And to your point, you know, you can't say enough good things about the training program, the NRA firearm safety training that goes on. It plays a huge part in all of this, you bet.
Yeah. So tell me, I mean, how easy is it for local law enforcement to be a part of this? And you know, if I wanted to just reach out to my, you know, county sheriff's office, could I do so as a civilian and say, hey, you guys should talk to NSSF about this?
Absolutely. If they can type on a computer and they have 2 minutes, they can become a partner and they can order locks. It's that simple. They just log on to our website, which is projectchildsafe.org. There's a button right there for law enforcement. The form comes up. They fill it out, tell us how many locks they want, and the locks will arrive 3 weeks later. That simple.
And how many states are you all in right now? Are you across the entire country?
We're operating in every state, and we've given locks out also in all five U.S. territories. So we're nationwide.
Wow, that is amazing. All right, so what are your plans for 2018? Obviously, this is not a new program, but you're constantly, I imagine, are looking at ways to reinvigorate this, put it into new directions and new outlets. So what do you have on tap for this year?
You bet. The biggest thing we're really doing is what we've done through some research is we found out that while we're reaching the shooting sports and the hunting community very well, the inner city urban communities, basically people who buy guns for self-protection but not necessarily for hunting or shooting sports, our messages need to reach deeper into those markets. We need to get more information and resources out to them. So that's going to be a big focus for us in 2018 is reaching those audiences.
Yeah, and I would imagine, too, that you know you almost have like a double whammy because in a lot of those urban environments, the impetus is on don't own a gun at all, right? So gun ownership is sort of a taboo thing as opposed to, okay, well, if you are going to own a gun, be safe about it. That's not the message that we're getting, unfortunately, from a lot of local governments. Their message is, don't own one of these things.
Right, and it's just, you know, it's self-defeating because it doesn't work. People are not going to stop owning a gun simply because their local mayor says that they shouldn't own one. And it's actually alienating the very audience you want to reach with a message like this when they do that.
Absolutely. Well, listen, that's why it's important that you're doing the work that you're doing. And Project Child Safe, again, taking place all around the country. If folks do want more information, what's the best way to find you online, Bill?
Just go to projectchildsafe.org. We even have a button on there for Find a Safety Kit. And they can click on that, enter their state and city. And if there's a local partner, they can just walk in, pick up a gun lock, no questions asked.
That is beautiful. Bill Romanelli with Project Child Safe.
Hey,
thank you so much, sir.
Pleasure.
Good to meet you. Projectchildsafe.org.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now here on NRA TV. Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire coming up this hour. Talk about what his employees and he did over the weekend. Selena Zito was talking about the flash flooding there in PA. I mean, honestly, like, we've gotten some afternoon storms here in Farmville, and it's, you know, a little bit of hail and some wind, but we haven't had to wrestle with the flash flooding that I guess they've had up to the north. And so in Woodland Park, New Jersey, yeah, it got bad. And a business not far from Gun for Hire's range starts flooding. And inside are dozens of pets, dogs, because this is a doggy daycare. Well, these dogs got a little field trip, and instead they got to spend the evening, some of them anyway, got to spend the evening there at Gun for Hire. Anthony even got nipped a little bit, but he said it's okay. It's all right. Dogs freaking out a little bit, as you might well imagine. But I think all is well. The kennel is now getting cleaned up, and hopefully the dogs are going to be back at the doggy daycare where they're supposed to be. But stepping up in times of need, that's what gun owners do around the country. We'll talk about that with Anthony Calandro later on in the hour. Also, here in about 20 minutes or so, our friend Lucretia Hughes is going to join us, Second Amendment activist. We'll share with you her Freedom Safest Place spot and talk with her about her latest activism. Meanwhile, I mentioned this with Selena Zito, a poll out, Gallup poll, showing Democrats more positive about socialism than capitalism. I talked with Grant Stinchfield on NRA TV about this earlier today. And going back a few years to 2010, Gallup has asked this question, do you have a positive view of socialism? Do you have a positive view of capitalism? And some people, honestly, have a positive view of both. I'm not sure how that works, given that socialism is kind of antithetical to the idea of free enterprise, but some of them do. And 10 years ago, back in 2010, breaking it down among Democrats and Republicans, 72% of Republicans had a positive view of capitalism. 17% of Republicans, according to Gallup anyway, had a positive view of socialism. Back in 2010, 53% of Democrats had a positive view of capitalism, and 53% of Democrats had a positive view of socialism. Just, again, there's some crossover in the Venn diagram where, you know, capitalism is great, socialism is great too, but capitalism is great. By 2018, this year, Republicans, when Gallup asked the same question, 71% of Republicans had a positive view of capitalism. And the numbers really hadn't changed that much, 72% in 2012, 68% in 2016, back up to 71% in 2018, really within the margin of error, you know, for close to a decade. And 16% of Republicans said they had a positive view of socialism. Again, would love to ask some of those Republicans why exactly, but that's what the numbers are, according to Gallup. Meanwhile, Democrats expressing a positive view of capitalism fell from actually a high of 56% in 2016 down to 47% this year. And those with a positive view of socialism remained pretty steady. It was 53% in 2010, 53% in 2012, up to 58% in 2016. So, yes, in 2016, 56% of Democrats said they had a positive view of capitalism, and 58% of Democrats said they had a positive view of socialism. I know. Can't figure that out. 2018, according to Gallup, 57% of Democrats say they have a positive view of socialism, 47% a positive view of capitalism. And most of this change has come from younger voters. If you look at, and Gallup separates it out between 18 to 29-year-olds, 30 to 49-year-olds, 50 to 64-year-olds, and those over the age of 65. And again, for most of these age ranges, you ask this question, you have a positive view of socialism, you have a positive view of capitalism, and the numbers have stayed pretty static for close to a decade. 2010, actually, you know, those over age 65 have actually become more supportive of capitalism. 2010, it was 54% had a positive view of capitalism. By this year, 60% positive view of capitalism. A positive view of socialism among those older Americans, 65 years of age or older, 30% positive view of socialism back in 2010, down to 28% in 2018. 50 to 64-year-olds, 60% positive view of capitalism, 30% positive view of socialism. 30 to 49-year-olds, 58% positive for capitalism, 41% positive view of socialism. 18 to 29-year-olds, 45% a positive view of capitalism. It's a drop of 12 points from 2016. And 51% with a positive view of socialism, which is also, by the way, a drop. Because back in 2016, 18 to 29-year-olds, 55% said that they had a positive view of socialism and 57% positive view of capitalism. So both numbers have declined among those younger Americans. Capitalism, though, far more than socialism. But that seems to be, when you get beyond the top line headline of Democrats prefer socialism, that's where it's coming from. It's coming from young Democrats, which is one of the reasons why you're starting to see some older Democrats and those who are on the fringe, Cynthia Nixon, running for governor of New York and running far behind Governor Andrew Cuomo, seizing on that label of Democratic Socialist after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got her primary victory, in the hopes, again, of appealing to that younger cohort of voters who also, by the way, are typically the least likely to show up on election day, but are the group, the demographic group that is most prized by advertisers, most prized by, those in the record industry, those in the entertainment industry. Movies are tailored for that audience. Music is certainly tailored for that audience. Even though they're less likely to vote, they matter culturally. And this is one of the reasons why I think you're seeing even some celebrities who would not fare well under socialism come out and proclaim themselves to be socialists, because that's where, again, they think the energy is on the left these days among those younger activists. And according to Gallup, they may be right. Again, I think the overall poll shows the problem for those self-proclaimed socialists as a nationwide political movement. But if you want to know where the growth is in the socialism industry, apparently there it is among younger voters out there. All right. Focusing also on some other Second Amendment news in Erie, Pennsylvania. Leaders there are looking at an ordinance that would ban the open carry of firearms in town-owned buildings. Now, this is actually a watered-down proposal, according to the Wheaton Business Journal. Previous proposal would have extended that same prohibition across the town of Erie's trail system and in their public parks as well. July 24th, they held a Board of Trustees meeting. And apparently, it was the weirdest thing, dozens of gun owners showed up at that board meeting, calling for a rejection of that sweeping gun ban. Yeah, local paper doesn't say anything about about dozens of gun control activists showing up for that meeting. But the gun owners were there. Erie Mayor Jennifer Carroll said, I understand that there are people who are really passionate about Second Amendment rights, and that whenever you're going to talk about guns or restrictions, there are going to be opinions on both sides of the issue. Well, yeah, I mean, there's, look, for any issue, there's going to be people on both sides. But yes, when you're telling people who are legal gun owners, hey, we're going to make it a criminal for you to try to be a legal gun owner over there, yes, you will find that those legal gun owners, those who are exercising their constitutional rights, they'll show up and they will speak their mind. And they'll, by the way, they won't just show up for the meetings. They'll show up on election day. They'll express their opinion at the ballot box too. So based on what happened at this local town meeting a few weeks ago, the town's coming back with another proposal. And by the way, I'm sorry, I said this was Erie, PA. This is actually Erie, Colorado, believe it or not. So a smaller community near Boulder, Colorado. And so we've actually seen in the wake of the Boulder gun ban, communities like Longmont and other communities around the Boulder area at least debate similar gun control moves, either a ban on semi-automatic firearms, or in the case of Erie, again, a ban on open carry in public places on town-owned property. Jennifer Carroll, the mayor there of Erie, said the proposal was originally introduced by town staff, who said, quote, I'm fine with bringing it to the board and discussing it and seeing it where it goes, but just because it's on our agenda doesn't mean that we're going to approve it. The reined-in proposal, according to the Wheaton Business Journal, unlikely to appease the town's gun rights activists. Well, yeah, because, again, like saying, well, we wanted a whole bunch of gun control, but we're going to settle for a medium amount of gun control. That's not compromise. That's really not. That's still gun owners giving up their rights and gun control activists coming back and saying, well, we'll get what we wanted next time around. That's not a compromise. That's just giving up your rights. Erie resident Jim Breyers was one of those gun owners who showed up at that town hall meeting last month. And he said, I'm very serious about upholding the Second Amendment. And I'm very concerned about ordinances that tend to vilify the Second Amendment. As the local press reports, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit says that the Second Amendment protects the right to openly carry a firearm in public for self-defense, the Young decision out of Hawaii. That's not, by the way, controlling in Colorado, because that is the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Erie's legal counsel said they believe the town's ordinance, if adopted, would not conflict with federal law. The bill would apply only to a handful of buildings, including Town Hall, the Erie Community Center, the police station, and public works facilities. Boulder, Superior, Colorado, have a nearly identical law. Lafayette, Colorado, bars its residents from openly carrying firearms in both city buildings and open space, according to its municipal code, which likely, by the way, is challengeable. And while similar laws in surrounding cities have been rather innocuous, the local press reports, officials say the stir in Erie is likely due to the town's divided political climate. Many of its citizens reside in the town's Weld County half, where, quote, right-leaning ideals and resistance to regulations on issues ranging from fracking to the Second Amendment abound. Well, we knew that the anti-gun activists weren't going to be satisfied just by passing their gun ban in Boulder. And now it looks again like they're taking their anti-gun platform on the road to communities across the state of Colorado, including Erie, Colorado there. So we'll keep our eyes on this proposal as it makes its way back before the city council. And I imagine they're going to be dealing with a packed crowd for that meeting as well there in Colorado. All right, stick around. When we come back, talking about another Second Amendment activist, Lucretia Hughes, who has certainly been in front of some crowds in Atlanta, Georgia, in defense and in support of her right to keep and bear arms. She'll be with us on the program after a couple of minutes, so stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company on the way.
Four liberals on the Supreme Court would take away your right to self-defense.
What does the Second Amendment mean to you?
It's not the right of an individual to keep a gun next to his bed.
Four liberal justices oppose your right to self-defense. Four justices support your right to self-defense. President Trump chose Brett Kavanaugh to break the tie. Your right to self-defense depends on this vote. Tell your senator, defend our right to self-defense. Confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you believe you have a right to defend yourself and your family with a firearm in your own home? Four Supreme Court justices say you do, but four say you don't, because the deciding vote announced he's retiring. And your most fundamental right to self-defense could be extinguished. This is our opportunity to protect the one freedom that guarantees all the others. The freedom that makes America different from every other country on earth. The Second Amendment is at stake. America is at stake. We are the last place on earth that still believes in the fundamental God-given right of self-defense. And we don't care if we're the last ones in the arena. We will never, ever stop fighting for this freedom. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
I'm a law-abiding citizen who's never shot anybody, never committed a serious crime, never committed a felony. But it seems like every time we have one of these shootings, nobody wants to put the blame where it goes, which is at the shooter's feet. You want to put it at my feet.
I felt like I needed to say something for all the people out there that I just spoke about, the people who have come together, who are together, who feel unified. That majority of people who obey the law, you know, and work hard every day, and are just tired of people trying to pull them apart and pull them in all different directions. I think there's millions of me across the country, and I'm hoping that each one of those people will go out and tell these politicians we're not going to take it, and we're going to stand up for our rights, and we're going to hold on to them. Anyone who is concerned with holding on to the Second Amendment, I absolutely think they should join the NRA.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together, collectively. And that's why I wanted to say, I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA, with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours, so no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military, and I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare, where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are.
I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me.
Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special, because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Coming up an hour from now, Andrew Langer with the Institute for Liberty and Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire later on in the hour, hoping to speak with Lucretia Hughes, Second Amendment advocate, here in a couple of minutes. If not, we'll try to get her rescheduled. Meanwhile, we've got an update for you on a hero of the day from several years ago. Because, again, the wheels of justice, they do grind slowly. So do you remember this was back in 2015 in Albuquerque, New Mexico? A couple, Lynn Russell and Chuck DeCaro, were assaulted in their motel room. Former CNN journalist. And it did. This was one of those armed citizen stories that actually got national attention, I think, because, A, we're talking about a couple of former reporters, so the media picks up on that. But B, we're talking about former reporters, one of whom was armed. Chuck DeCaro was able to save his wife's life by shooting and killing her attacker. So her attacker is dead, but the guy who police charged was apparently for lack of a better word, low-level criminal mastermind. Here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. His name's Sky Bars. And he was actually sentenced to 13 years behind bars for his role in the attempted robbery of Chuck DeCaro and Lynn Russell back in 2015. Lynn Russell said, we walked into the courtroom and Sky Bars knew immediately. She said that the sentencing, something that she's been looking forward to for the last 3 years. It was summer of 2015. Russell and Chuck DeCaro were on their way from D.C. to California. And they stopped for the night, Motel 6. Russell said she was getting something from her car when a guy named Tamario Walton pointed a gun at her, forced her back inside the motel room. She said that Walton got frustrated because she was taking too long to get her stuff together to give him. Chuck DeCaro, meanwhile, is in the bathroom. He's in the shower. He walks out, sees what's going on, grabs his gun. He said, my wife was going to live. And whatever it took, I just did my duty. It's very simple. Chuck DeCaro was shot 3 times by Walton. He recovered. Walton died at the hospital. And then police say this guy, Sky Bars, was the guy who was really behind this attempted robbery. They say that Bars kept Walton as a, quote, slave to commit crimes for him. Crazy. Bars was initially charged with murder. Now, he did take a plea deal, pled guilty to reduced charges, and under the terms of the plea deal, the judge in the case, Benjamin Chavez, would determine if Sky Bars got 4 years, which is the minimum, 13 years, which was the maximum, or somewhere in between. Chuck DeCaro says when the sentence came, it was exactly what we wanted, which was the full sentence of 13 years. Meanwhile, they say that, you know, it's been 3 years, but that night is never really going to be behind them. Lynn Russell said, I see it in slow motion all the time. My PTSD therapist says this will never stop. By the way, Bars, it should be noted, has a quote, lengthy criminal history, according to local authorities, with several prior felony convictions. Won't get a chance to rack up another one for, probably close to a decade. There. So an update for you on an earlier hero of the day story. Meanwhile, this one almost made our deal of the day, but it's broader than just one case. We saw Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago, Illinois, actually last week, you know, in a press conference, blaming the gun laws of the country for the violence in Chicago. Basically blaming anything and everything other than himself. Right. You can blame the guns. You can blame the lack of jobs. You can blame the criminal justice system. You can blame whatever you want. Just don't blame me. And one of the things that Rahm Emanuel said when he was throwing the kitchen sink out there, he talked about people who are not willing to cooperate with the local authorities. And this is an issue not just in Chicago, but even in the small town of Lima, Ohio, this is an issue. And we'll talk about that, actually, here in a couple of minutes. But right now, we do have Lucretia Hughes with us on the program. I want to spend some time with Lucretia. Lucretia, how are you today?
Hey, Cam. How are you doing?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. Hey, listen, before we get started, I want folks to see this video. We've been playing it during some of our commercial breaks, but if folks have missed this, check out Lucretia's Freedom Safest Place spot for the National Rifle Association.
Politicians are very good at playing with words. They always talk about gun control. How about right control? Because when you go against the Second Amendment, that's our right. That's our God-given right, not only by God, but by the Founding Fathers. So why don't you just call it what it really is, right control? You're taking our rights away. You cannot regulate evil. Evil is evil, and evil is always going to be persistent, and it's always going to be here. So why get rid of our ability to protect ourselves? The Second Amendment right protects the rest of them, and it protects us. It protects your home, your body, and your spirit, because without it, how are you going to protect yourself? Don't be a sheep. Don't follow just because it's popular. Think for yourself. Be yourself. Be that individual that God made you to be. He wasn't born to follow. He was born to lead.
There you go. Lucretia Hughes with us here on Cam and Company. And Lucretia, I got to tell you, you know, watching that, I've had the opportunity to talk with you a number of times in the past, and I just walk away so energized after every opportunity we get a chance to spend some time together because, I mean, you are just you are a dynamo when it comes to standing up for your rights.
Well, I appreciate it, and I always tell you, I thank you for seeing something in me that a lot of people don't see, so I really appreciate the kind words that you're doing.
Absolutely, and you know, look, you're down there in Georgia. This is a state where I think the Second Amendment is going to be an election issue, both for governor's race. I know that Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate, recently talked about wanting to repeal campus carry. You know, has talked about her support for a number of gun control laws. I'm sure there are going to be some local races down there as well. I mean, I'm curious, Lucretia, as a relatively new member of the NRA, but certainly an outspoken supporter of the right to keep and bear arms, when you hear politicians talking about taking away your rights in the name of safety, what's your response to that?
Keep your hands off my weapons. Keep your hands off my guns. Keep your hands off my ways of protecting myself. And every time a politician try to tug at the heartstrings, then you know what they're talking about is false. Number one, we have the rights. And in the state of Georgia, it is a red state. So with Stacey Abrams running for governor, thinking the first thing that comes out of her mouth is that she wants to repeal or take away and confiscate our guns, that's no-no number one. And no-no number two is her trying to attack Stone Mountain, which has four Confederate soldiers on it. So if that is what you're actually pushing to think you're becoming the governor of Georgia, then you need to get some better talking points. Because before the Georgians allow Stone Mountain to be erased and our guns to be taken, we will go to the ballot in droves, as we saw in the last election.
I mean, I'm curious, Lucretia, you know, because you are involved in your community. Those seem like two issues that Georgians, like, aren't really big issues for Georgians. You know, I mean, I'm looking at some of the polling around the country, and the big issues that I'm seeing are things like jobs, the economy, health care, immigration's actually ticked up over the last couple of months. I'm not seeing things like repealing campus carry or, you know, blowing up Stone Mountain or whatever the heck they would want to do to Stone Mountain. I mean, you know, what are the real issues you think right now facing Georgians?
The same issues that it is in all America. It's the kitchen table issues. How are we going to balance our budgets? How are we going to bring more money in the house? How are we going to have great schools? How are we going to talk about health care? That is the issues in the state of Georgia. The only thing the left and the Democrats has for it is social justice issues, because everything else is being accomplished under the Trump administration. So that's the only thing they have to run on. And when the first thing that Stacey Abrams said was that she wants to make it a law where they come around to our homes and actually take our guns. If anything, you're about to get the citizens of Georgia in an outrage. Number one, don't touch our guns, and don't touch Stone Mountain.
talking with Lucretia Hughes, Second Amendment activist. And, you know, there were over the weekend, there were more than 1,000 gun control activists in Atlanta. It was the Moms Demand Action Gun Sense University. And not only were the gun control activists there learning how to be effective anti-gun activists and volunteers, but a lot of them were learning how to run for office. They were learning how to, you know, go from being a political activist to being a political official. And I want to ask you, Lucretia, I mean, as somebody who, again, has been involved in these issues from a very grassroots perspective, when you look and you see the money that's being spent by folks like Michael Bloomberg, the outreach that they're engaging in, again, to try to turn, you know, activists into elected officials, what is your response? What is your message for other gun owners around the country so that, you know, again, we're prepared, we can stand up and we can defend our rights?
13% of the people that's out there on the front line, we need more feet on the ground. We need more people to take the gun control and the gun rights issue very seriously. We need to finally stand up. I think people have fallen to sleep because we do have Trump in office. You cannot sit down on your laurels when you have a state like Georgia that has been red, but now you have in the blues coming over here from Hollywood to big business to big corporations. They're trying to turn our state purple. That's not going to happen. So just because you have the Bloombergs of the world and you have the Soroses of the world and you have all these left-leaning nutcases coming into the state of Georgia, that is when the Georgians need to stand up and say, no, you're not going to take our state over. We're going to stand firm. We're going to stand strong. And we're going to get out there on the front line and do what we have to do, not only to save our state, but to save our nation.
Lucretia Hughes, Second Amendment activist. Listen, how can we help you and what you're doing down there in Georgia?
Well, I will be in Washington, D.C., April the 8th. For the Mother of All rallies, I have an opportunity to speak and speak about the Second Amendment, also gun rights, and also about the NRA. Thank you. But also, I have a T-shirt line that helps me with the T-shirts and the hats, and it's at www.libbysouls.net. And I also still have the GoFundMe because when people contribute, it allows me to get to Dallas. It allows me to get to Virginia, get to Florida, get to South Carolina. Because see, people see something in me where they want me to come and speak. So that is at GoFundMe, a true American patriot, because you're not going to get anybody that is more firm when it comes to the foundations of the United States. And I'm not wishy-washy.
Nah, I don't think anybody would ever use that term to describe you, Lucretia. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program as always. It is so good to see you today, and I look forward to talking again very soon.
Absolutely. I'll see you, Cam.
All right. Thanks, Lucretia. Lucretia Hughes on Twitter at, I know it. I just don't have it right in front of me. Cree45, I think. CRE45. All right. Speaking of Georgia, by the way, this is a fairly interesting. This is from Resonate. Georgia voters split on top voting issues. So this was recently, this was this election cycle, asking voters in Georgia, what are the most important issues for you? Among Democrats, by the way, and according to Resonate, their voting sample that they found, 38% Republican, 32% Democrat, 23% Independent, and then 7% Other. For Democrats, top issues this year in Georgia: education, health care, job creation, not gun control. Health care, job creation, education. For Republicans, balanced budget, defense / military, government spending. Government spending, by the way, number one with a pretty wide margin for Republicans. Among independents, government spending, health care, job creation. Gun control, not a top issue for Democrats in Georgia or for independents in Georgia. As a matter of fact, Resonate looked at the most polarizing issues for Republicans and Democrats. Compared to each other, what are the most polarizing policy issues for Democratic and Republican voters? for Republican voters, the most polarizing issue, Second Amendment rights. Like, that's the one issue that Republicans, again, not only is it one where you're most out of line with a lot of what the Democratic politicians are spouting, but the intensity of that issue for Republicans. For Democrats, it was gay and lesbian rights. That was the most polarizing issue on the left. But again, you know, one of the big questions for gun control activists is, you know, they've been proclaiming now for months, this is the election where it's okay to talk about gun control. Never mind the elections, the special elections where the Democrats who are running aren't talking about gun control. This is the year where you can talk about banning guns. This is the year where you can talk about background checks. This is the year. Not only can you, but you should be talking about these things. Now, there's really little evidence that that's an issue that yet a lot of Americans are really clamoring for. You go back, you look at that special election in Ohio that was held last week, and still too close to call officially. Troy Balderson with a narrow lead, the Republican. The Democrat, Danny O'Connor, close behind. But he didn't run as a let's ban all the guns Democrat. He did not, again, on it. He had the endorsement of Moms Demand Action, but he wasn't touting it. There was nowhere to be found on his campaign website. So it's not that he wasn't anti-gun, because he had the backing of Moms Demand Action. But it was going to be a drawback if that became a campaign issue. It was going to be a negative. So it wasn't something he wanted to promote. It wasn't something he wanted to put out there. I just think it's interesting to note that what we're seeing in the press, these types of stories about, oh, come on in, the gun control water's great, doesn't necessarily match up with the reality on the ground in a lot of these races. Again, we'll see what happens come November, but evidence right now showing that the big push for gun control in Georgia not likely to lead to a lot of new voters for the Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams there. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we return, I love this story. Anthony Calandra is going to join us from Gun for Hire, the 2017 NRA ILA Volunteer of the Year. And you know what? He's probably going to get an award from the local animal shelters there in North Jersey as well. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up next.
Following the latest developments out of Texas, where at least 26 people died in a mass shooting at a church.
All that keeps going through my head is why? Because it doesn't make sense, and I doubt it'll ever make sense. I think he's a coward. Any man that's going to take a gun against women and children is a coward.
The shooter had been in that church before. Why would he come back and do this in your town?
It's got to be Satan, the devil. You know, if you've got God and good, you've got to have evil to understand good.
He had no mercy, did he?
No, he had none at all.
I can tell you that the scene in there is horrific, is not even a word to describe it.
I was at home, and my other daughter-in-law, Leslie, she had called me that her shots fired by the church. You know, you think, well, it's the country, people shoot guns. I got dressed and got her dressed, and I said, well, let's go up to the by the church and talk to the police officer and see where they're taking people so we could find Joanna and the girls. There was a social worker at the hospital that was trying to identify people, and she said they found a little 8-year-old that was unidentified, and they were asking me to describe Emily. So I showed him a picture on my phone because I'm a grandma. I always have grand pictures, you know. And he said they did finally identify her by the picture, and she was in surgery, but she was critical. Emily died later that day while they were working on her. You know, you're like, where's their mama? Because these kids, they want their mama. And we kept hoping and hoping. Chris, my son, he went into the church to see if Joanne was in there. He went in there and saw all the bodies and the blood, and you can't imagine. And he's thinking, my family was in this. And like they said, they couldn't show pictures of her. She was so shot up. because she had thrown her body over the three little ones to try to protect them. So you know, if Rylan got shot and Emily got shot and died and Brooks did, you know that a lot of them had to go through her, the bullets that hit them. She was holding Brooke, which is her baby, the little five-year-old. They shared the same birthday. She just turned 30 and Brooke just turned 5 in August.
And Rylan is really a miracle. Five-year-old shot 5 times.
The little five-year-old. You know, who would do that? What kind of person would do something like that? Actually, it's the Sunday school teacher who was a nurse, and she put tourniquets on him, and the doctor told us whoever put the tourniquets on Rylan saved his life.
When you look back at what happened, could you ever have imagined this happening in your town?
I could never imagine this happening anywhere, in any town. Apparently, they have no conscience, nothing. I'm just numb. Those people that do this are cowards, and they'll do it because they know people at church are armed. I mean, that's why I said we're a small town. It takes a while for police to get here.
You look at Steve Williford. He took the risk, and he stopped that man as soon as he could with his own firearm.
I kept hearing those shots, and I knew every shot might be representing another person getting hit by a bullet.
He's a hero. He says he's not, but what he is.
That's the way the whole town is. We don't think about ourselves. We think about other people. And he wasn't probably like me, not thinking about the danger to himself, but he was thinking about those families in that church and those kids in that church. But everybody in this community, there's so many people that would do that. I had people tell me, they said, nobody had a gun in church, which Texas, you know. And I said, yeah, but you don't think about, I'm going to church, I'll need a gun. That'll probably change now. And I said, yeah, I'm sure. If people are allowed to carry guns that are good at law-abiding, this wouldn't have happened. He would have been dead. He might have shot a few people, but he wouldn't have got everybody that he got.
So you think it's important the Attorney General has come out and said, you know what? We need to have more people carrying firearms in church. What do you think?
I think many people are carrying firearms everywhere. The ones that are law-abiding citizens that love people and give their life for other people to do it.
Steve stepped up. What would have happened if he didn't do what he did to stop that shooter?
No, if he hadn't had guns, there would have been a lot of other people killed, a lot more people. It would have been two or three times as many people killed.
Does it make you angry when you see what happened here and immediately you have politicians screaming for more gun
laws? Yes, very much. We don't need more gun laws. Good, honest people need guns to protect themselves from the criminals. If there would have been people in that church with a gun, this wouldn't have gone as far as it did. I doubt, seriously, if he knew there were people in that church with a gun, he wouldn't have gone in there. Why can't law-abiding citizens have guns? They're going to take our guns, and the only ones with guns is going to be criminals, because they're going to get them.
As tough as it is, you've got to feel proud that as a community, you're sticking together.
I know it's a great community, but just the way everybody stepped up, people all over the country, all over the world, it's amazing. I've never seen so much love and outpouring.
Going to the vigil, holding hands, that must be very powerful.
Yeah. All right. It's because we love each other, we care about each other, and we're pulled together, and God, that's the main thing.
Welcome back. It is your first source for Second Amendment news and information all across the nation. It is Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well. And, you know, our own Katie had to deal with some water issues earlier today. Isn't homeownership fun, Katie? So much fun. I know. But at least Katie didn't have to deal with a flash flood. A little bit. Kind of a minor one. But up in New Jersey, man, it was bad this weekend. As a matter of fact, coming up in hour three, we've got our good guy of the day, which also comes from the flooded streets of New Jersey. But I hear with a bit of a good guy early. I think it's fair to say that Anthony Calandro and the folks at Gun for Hire were certainly good guys and gals this weekend. Anthony, welcome to the program, sir. Thanks for your time today.
Hey, Cam. How are you? How's everything?
You know, we're all good down here. All dry. It's sun is shining. It's great. But I didn't realize how bad the flooding was where you are.
Well, a car dealership on the other side of the highway parked all of their vehicles, new vehicles, close to the river, and they had a mudslide from the heavy rains, and about 20 of their brand new Jeeps slid into the river, causing a dam, and the Peckman River forded over onto the streets, And at 6 p.m., I had a full range. I had an hour of wait of customers. The water went from 0 inches to 3 feet high in 15 minutes.
Holy smokes.
Cars were spinning down the street. Cars were spinning down the street like tops.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yes. And so how did you guys hear about what was happening a few doors down from you at the dog sitting place?
We stayed here. We put some sandbags in front of our front door, me and my excellent staff. And the fire department finally came and said, there's electrical wires in the water. We have to evacuate you. So we went out of the building of the new addition. We're building a two-story range attached to the original addition. And right behind us, maybe 100 yards behind us, is a building called Club Barks, where you can leave your dogs when you go on vacation, overnight or whatever. And we heard yelping and we heard dogs screaming. So my guys, all my red shirts, my RSOs and a few managers, they ran over with the fire department and they saw that the water was literally about 3 feet high at the front door. So they got the fire department to open the door. There was two techs in there working with the dogs, but there was 72 dogs and there were crates floating in the water with the smaller dogs, and the medium dogs that the crates weren't floating, the water was up to their stomachs and their throats. So my guys grabbed the fire department. Jimmy called me on my cell phone at our building and said, can we bring the dogs over here? And we basically, with the fire department and gun for hire pickup trucks, we did a bucket brigade. We took 17 dogs. The Woodland Park Fire Department took a bunch of dogs, and Club Bark stayed with some of the dogs at their facility on higher ground, putting the dogs on countertops. So my staff waded through water waist deep. One guy hurt his foot. One of my guys lost his cell phone, which we've since replaced. But from 8:30 till about midnight, we got all the dogs secured in our range, and we stayed all night to clean up the range. So we were basically dog walking and feeding them. And the gun in my gun store, we have Ottaminelli Sporting Arms. They're a gun store in my gun range. The owner's wife went home and got about 30 blankets. We went and got dog food. They went and got water. A lot of the dogs were, you know, pooping in their cages and stuff. They were nervous. They were traumatized. So it was a long night. And then the water started to recede after about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we started our cleanup here. And we managed to open only 2 hours late on Sunday. But the text came over from Club Barks about 9 in the morning. We had taken care of the dogs all night. And they started to take the dogs back to their facility around 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. I got bit by one of the dogs named Logan. The dogs were scared, Cam. My dogs that work with me every day. And a couple of my other guys got nipped. But all in all, it was a wonderful thing to do. You know, they say you're only as good as your people. My staff, the guys that own the gun store, Ottaminelli's, nobody questioned it. You know, we just jumped to it and did whatever we had to do. The dogs literally would have drowned if my guys hadn't stepped in and taken care of this situation.
That's absolutely unbelievable. And I know I watched the CBS New York story. They interviewed the owner of Club Barks, who said that, you know, he was so grateful for what your staff and what you did. And, you know, he said he talked to you and said, if there's anything I can do for you, you know, you just let me know. And, you know, I mean, Anthony, I know that we've talked before about what it's like to have a gun range 15 miles from New York City. And part of, I think, what allows you to succeed is the fact that you are a part of that community.
Yes.
And clearly this is the case, right? I mean, when you guys saw something that needed action, you were there to act. And you became, I think you demonstrated that you are an invaluable part of the community there.
We are indeed. You know, it was hostile when we first opened 6 years ago, and I've managed to win everybody over, you know, police, the electorate, and fire, and the community. And I get along with Club Barks, the owner. A lot of my staff uses their facilities. And, you know, we break the narrative here at the Gun for Hire range, and my employees proved that night. We don't care. You know, somebody needs help. Someone's in distress. That's what we do. And everybody just called arms. Everybody went out. Did what they had to do, personal sacrifices, secure the dogs, make sure none of them get hurt. And all the dogs were rescued, by the way. Not one dog lost their life or got hurt, which is phenomenal, because to see water go from 0 to 3 feet in a matter of 15 minutes and stay that way for about 5 hours is phenomenal. We had cars in our parking lot floating around. two of my employees' cars got flooded. Numerous customers' cars are still being towed out of our parking lot right now. It's never happened on this property before, but, you know, we break that narrative, and my people just jumped to it and did it, and then they worked all night to make sure the range was ready to open 8 in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning. We had a second shift come in. All we kept doing was checking on the dogs, and, you know, it's funny. I got coverage from two New York media outlets, but zero from any New Jersey media outlets for what my staff did to save those dogs because, you know, our governor, Governor Phil Murphy, signed a bill. He gave a $5 million grant to all the New Jersey media outlets to support them. Mm-hmm. So we have state-run media in New Jersey now, like you would see in Venezuela. So they're not going to cover something that he's against, because if we were a McDonald's and we saved those dogs, it would have been all over the local media. But because we're a gun range, not a peep out of any of the state-run, state-funded media.
That's amazing. Because you said you got, I mean, you got attention from New York media, New York City,
yes.
CBS New York, big story, and nothing from
nothing.
Right there in your own backyard.
Correct. But when there's a mass shooting, my phone is not ringing. Everybody wants to come in and interview me and take pictures of the evil black rifles. Here, 72 dogs' lives were saved. And who doesn't love animals? If you don't love animals, I don't love you. That's how I look at it. And, you know, the state-run media is totally silent on the issue.
Well, listen, you know, I know you didn't do it for the media attention, but would have been nice to have some of the local press at least report on what had happened. But, you know, listen, thank you again, Anthony, for all your staff, and please thank all your staff there. I mean, again, it's amazing you did that. You pulled an all-nighter, and the men and women working for you are still able to open up, as you say, just 2 hours late.
Two hours late.
That's just incredible. That's absolutely incredible.
I'm humbled,
yeah,
actually.
As you should be,
yes.
Especially proud, because again, it sounds like you've got a lot of great folks that are working there, good ambassadors for the Second Amendment, and hopefully, you know, you got a chance to play with a few of the dogs anyway for a little bit, right?
Oh, we did. Even the dog that bit me, I took him for a nice long walk.
Excellent. Hey, Anthony, thank you so much, sir, for all that you do, and thanks for coming to the program today.
Thank you, Cam. Keep doing what you do.
Thank you so much, sir. Anthony Calandra, join us from Gun for Hire on Twitter at Gun, and then the number 4, and then HYR, Gun for Hire. Top of the hour, we have today's Hero of the Day. We have our Deal of the Day. We have our Good Guy coming up as well. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty is going to join us on the program. Dave Kopel from the Independence Institute will join us on the program as well, coming up in Hour 3. And they are still talking in Canada about banning handguns. Yeah, still. Thomas Walcom with a piece in the Toronto Star over the weekend. Ottawa needs to make handgun ownership more difficult. If gun violence, he says, is to be reduced, the federal Liberal government must make it harder to obtain restricted weapons. That is self-evident, he says. And he says it is also what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government is extremely reluctant to do. 241 shootings in Toronto this year, double what it was 4 years ago. But by the way, still really hard to legally get a gun in Canada. 4 years ago and today. But the columnist for the Toronto Star says that the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, wants to give law enforcers more money. He says Ford's not wrong in devoting more money to police. Policing alone may not be enough to lower gun crime substantially, but it is necessary. But he says where Ford is wrong is the assumption that nothing else is needed. He says there are reasons why people resort to gun violence, sometimes mental health. Sometimes the people are just jerks. But he says to refuse to deal with the reasons behind gun violence is to risk failure. Now, in my mind, banning guns isn't really getting behind the reasons behind violent crime. That's a different issue, according to this columnist. He says it's up to Ottawa to set the rules for who may own guns. And when it comes to handguns, he says, these rules are too lax. They're in Ottawa. The Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police says 50% of the handguns used in crimes that its members have been able to trace were, quote, diverted from legal Canadian firearms owners. Sometimes they're stolen. Sometimes their legal owners sold them on the black market. And this columnist says, look, some gun owners Some gun owners need handguns, like a security guard. Maybe you need a handgun if you're a security guard. But most gun owners, he says, don't need their handguns at all. They either collect handguns or they use them for sport. This columnist says, I see the attraction that guns hold. I used to own two rifles. He says, a firearm can be an intricate and beautiful piece of machinery, but so is a cuckoo clock, which is less dangerous. So we should go ahead and be able to ban the firearms. He notes the liberal government's reluctance. He calls it the reluctance to be bold. In other words, the reluctance to embrace a ban on handguns. Notes the liberals' last serious attempt to pass gun control laws, the 1995 long gun registry, was a political disaster. But not just a political disaster, by the way. It didn't work. The reason why it was a political disaster is because it didn't work. Trying to register every long gun in Canada didn't work, which is why it was so disastrous. Cost a lot of money to try to put this registry together, billions of dollars, and it didn't work. But we should not be deterred because of that, not according to this columnist for the Toronto Star. And he says, actually, you know, this Toronto City Council wants to ban the sale of handguns in Toronto. That's not a useful idea, he says. That would just encourage more gun shops to open in neighboring communities. A better idea, rather than just banning guns in Toronto, a better idea would be to ban guns nationwide. Yeah, that's what Thomas Walkham says. Limit handgun ownership across Canada to those who can prove that they need such a an item. And again, in Canada, you know, self-defense is not really a valid reason, right? So we could just have a gun ban in one fell swoop. God bless the USA. Stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company. It's coming up next. Talk with Kevin Dixie from No Other Choice Firearms Training. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So tell me about No Other Choice Firearms Training.
The philosophy behind the training company is this. No Other Choice is just that. So we go out, we want to train people, get them protecting themselves, understanding what the Second Amendment is. However, before you ever use that skill set, no matter what you learn in class, you ever use anything, whether it be a bat, gun, car, against anybody else, you should be at a point of no other choice. You tried to run from the situation, talk your way out of the situation, avoid it altogether, and never be there before you ever think about impacting a human life, even if they so quote-unquote deserve it. Make sure you're at a point of no other choice.
You know, and it's. I'm glad that you're emphasizing that, because one of, I think, the misconceptions that we have about concealed carry holders, about gun owners in general, is that we're all a bunch of trigger-happy nuts, right? Who are just looking for an excuse to whip out our gun, when that is the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, if we're ever in a position where you have to defend your life, I don't know about you, Kevin, I never want to be in that position where I have to defend my life.
Right. I've been carrying a gun almost 20 years now, and I've never had to deploy that gun. Now, I've had to deploy it in my form of work before, as far as a defensive tool to do my job, but I've never had to actually discharge a firearm against another human being, because they've always made the smart option of, hey, okay, this is going too far, let's stop. So I disagree with that. I mean, how many people are carrying guns today? And nobody's getting hurt, right? I think concealed carriers are some of the best people walking the face of the earth, because they have godlike power, and they respect it more than anything else. So it's totally false.
So how did you get into gun ownership? How did you get into firearms training?
I was working at the St. Louis City Police Department. I worked in the jail division, and I saw a lot of individuals that were making, good people making bad choices. Well, along with that job came a lot of firearms exposure and training and things like that. So I decided to kind of blend two things. I took the training opportunities, got into guns, started understanding my rights a lot more at the age of 21. And then I also wanted to train people not only to defend themselves against the guys I was working with every day, but also help people that were just making bad decisions to make better decisions, you know, so they're not in situations. So that went to training. Let's teach you how to defend yourself and be safe against some of the evil people in the world. But let's also prevent you from becoming a person that's a good person but making mistakes. And let's blend the two. And that's how it started.
You know, in St. Louis itself, where you're based, right, and you look at Chicago, you look at St. Louis, you look even in places like New York City or Washington, D.C., Baltimore, you got a lot of violent crime, but you don't have, I think, a cultural or a political push towards responsible gun ownership. It's almost the other direction. They don't want anybody to be gun owners, as opposed to wanting to make sure that training is available for anybody who wants to become a legal gun owner.
Correct. And the reason for that is because guns are polarizing, right? It's a polarizing subject. And a lot of people want to work on the emotion of the community. They want, you know, if you walk outside every day and your situation isn't the best, cosmetically your area isn't the best, it's easy for me to play on your emotions, right? And tell you that, hey, these guys are bad. Trust me. Let me defend you. And what I'm trying to tell people is, let's get you out. Let's show you what life is. Let's help you out with resources. Once you understand what you're working for, please understand that there is somebody walking this earth that will take that from you in a blink of an eye. So instead of trying to depower you to trust me, I want to empower you for you can protect everything you work hard for. And so whether it's in your current situation or you just want to work hard to get out of your situation, you need to understand you have to have the power to protect yourself. Regardless of what somebody politically is trying to drive you to, understand, take your own responsibility. It's safe. It's fun. It's the ultimate equalizer. And everybody that does it has a level of respect that is ungodly. And you need to understand that and just take it upon yourself.
So 10 seconds or less, Kevin, who is showing up for your training sessions these days?
Everybody. I teach and train everybody, but I have seen a great, great big push in women, and I love it. Women, and I'm getting a lot more anti-gunners in, so it's always fun for me.
How about that? Kevin Dixie. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. If folks want more information, where can they get it?
You can look on Facebook at NOC for No Other Choice Firearms Training. You can also look me up, Kevin Dixie, D-I-X-I-E. That's on Facebook, and on Instagram, it's at NOC Firearms Training, all one word.
Kevin Dixie with No Other Choice Firearms Training here on Cam and Company.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three. How is it already hour three of Cam and Company? Starts right now here on NRA TV. Over the course of the next 60 minutes, Andrew Langer joins us from the Institute for Liberty. We'll talk about that new study showing that academics really don't like NRA members. Yeah, if you're an aspiring professor, you're looking to get hired, don't let them know that you're an NRA member, because apparently that's the worst thing that you could say. Apparently it polls worse than things like, I'm a cannibal. Yeah, I know. I don't get it either. But we'll talk about it with Andrew Langer later in the hour. Dave Kopel, Research Director at the Independence Institute, will join us on the program as well. We also have our Hero of the Day, our Deal of the Day, and our good guy of the day that we will get to here momentarily. There we go. All right, just having a little trouble finding that. All right. Yes, today's Hero of the Day is where we will begin. And the Hero of the Day today comes to us from WBTV. This is a, I got to tell you, NRA actually tweeted this story out earlier today. Channel 3 in Atlanta, Georgia, but the story itself is from Forest City, North Carolina. A 15-year-old girl forced to shoot and kill her mother's boyfriend, acting in defense of her mom. She's not going to be facing charges, according to the DA's office. And this was a Wednesday night. Rutherford County deputies called to a home in Forest City about a shooting. When they got there, they found an individual, Stephen Kelly, with two gunshot wounds. Deputies learned that Kelly and his girlfriend, as well as her three children, a 12-year-old boy and 15 and 16-year-old girls, had recently moved to the area from Indiana. Investigators determined that Kelly had attacked his girlfriend and was choking her, yelling that he was going to cut her throat and kill everyone in the house. That is when the victim's son went and got a gun, and the victim's 15-year-old daughter took the gun from her brother and fired it twice, hitting Kelly in the chest. Deputies say that one of the rounds fragmented and grazed the 16-year-old daughter. She was taken to a local hospital, was released the next day. Deputies said that the victim had significant bruises from the attack by her boyfriend. Deputies say they also learned that Kelly had threatened the victim repeatedly. Back on August the 4th, he had assaulted her and had actually fired a gun several times inside the home to threaten and terrorize her. Deputies say that Kelly, who was a convicted felon, had multiple firearms in the home, frequently carried one as well, had two active domestic violence protection orders against him from two different women, one in Indiana and one in Ohio. Deputies say that no domestic violence or assaults have been reported to law enforcement agencies before last Wednesday's attack. They presented the case to the DA's office. DA's office said, based on the facts and the evidence, that the shooting was justified, no charges will be filed. And again, an awful situation for that family to find themselves in, but thankfully, they are okay. Now we've got another, armed citizen for you as well, another hero of the day. This one from Indianapolis, Indiana. And this was Sunday evening. Excuse me. This was Saturday evening, about 6:30 Saturday afternoon, at a get-go gas station. Police got a call about an armed man attempting to rob that convenience store. Police say the man arrived at the get-go in a stolen vehicle. And police say when he pulled out a gun, two armed customers, not one, but two armed customers, fired shots at the suspect. Indianapolis Metro Police Department found the suspect there at the gas station, critical condition from a gunshot wound. EMS transported him. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. Police are continuing to investigate, but it looks like, again, a case of armed self-defense there in Indianapolis, Indiana. We'll keep our eyes on that story and give you any details as they become available. Meanwhile, on to our deal of the day. I've got a couple of those for you as well. First, from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, a story about a guy named Jack Banks. Headline, Arkansas man receives seventh jail term, 10th conviction, son faces capital murder charge. Now, I got to say, this piece by the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette is a lengthy story. Don't have time to get to the entire thing, but it's well worth a read. We'll tweet this out at Cam and Company. Jack Banks, at age 14, led police in a high-speed chase while his teenage passenger fired a shotgun at pursuing officers. At age 15, Banks was one of six youths who attacked a 37-year-old father of two while stealing his necklace. The 37-year-old father of two ended up trying to flee into a street in Little Rock where he was killed by a hit-and-run driver. On his 16th birthday, Jack Banks accepted a 15-year prison sentence after pleading guilty to the resulting robbery and manslaughter charges. Back in 1991, he said, I just got in with the wrong people. That was the first of six times that Jack Banks would be sent to prison. And as the Democrat Gazette reports, Banks has either been behind bars or on parole or probation every day of his life since he was 16 years old. Last Thursday, a month before Banks turns 43, U.S. District Judge Christine Baker handed down a seventh prison sentence, at least his 10th felony conviction. This time, he's going to federal prison, nearly 7.5 years, as a result of a 2016 traffic stop that led to a guilty plea for being a felon in possession of a firearm. He said, I know my past is what it is, but it is my past. I haven't been perfect growing up, but I've come a long ways in life. And now he says, I have someone that's repeating my past, and it hurts. He took a turn because of me. Banks was talking about his son, Jack Banks III, 15 years old, who's now been charged with capital murder, attempted capital murder, and aggravated robbery. The youngest of four teenagers in North Little Rock, Arkansas, accused of shooting two men at a skate park back on July 16th. 22-year-old Armin Van Tonder of Cabot, Arkansas, was killed in that shooting. 18-year-old Jacob Bynum of Jacksonville was wounded. Jack Banks told the judge at his sentencing, I'm tired of living this way. I'm ready for a change. His attorney, Lisa Peters, asking for leniency from the judge, said he's done some horrible things, but he's a good person. The assistant U.S. attorney told the judge, Your Honor, he's had a criminal history since he was 14, and it only ends at age 42 because he's been locked up. The judge eventually told him, I need to look at the past to inform consequences today. And she said, I don't believe the past has defined you. I don't think it is ever too late to change. But you're not getting off lightly this time around. 7.5 years for Jack Banks on his 10th felony conviction and his 7th time behind bars. Hopefully this time will be the turnaround that Mr. Banks has been looking for. Now, our second deal of the day from the Star News Online, Wilmington, North Carolina, 22-year-old Greer Hayes Old was arrested Saturday night after a manhunt following a shooting in the Forest Hills area of Wilmington, North Carolina. As it turns out, this guy that they arrested was also wanted for a shooting last week in Wilmington, North Carolina. Yeah, he's now been charged with resisting, delaying, or obstructing an officer fleeing to elude arrest. Firearm possession by a convicted felon. I mentioned this young man's 22 years of age. Already a convicted felon. Possession of a stolen firearm. And assault on a government official with intent to kill. As of yesterday, a second suspect remains at large. Assault started Saturday night, about 7 p.m. Police got a tip that Mr. Old was staying at a local motel. Old wanted in connection with a shooting last Thursday that left a 28-year-old with non-life-threatening wounds. Police arrived there at the motel. Old and another man got in a vehicle. A chase ensues with Old behind the wheel of the car. Went to a local park where the pair jumped from the vehicle, then fled on foot. Police said officers and one of the men exchanged gunfire, but nobody was injured. Officers arrested Old about an hour later. According to records from the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, Old currently on probation for a 2017 conviction in New Hanover County for larceny, felony common law robbery, as well as felony possession of a Schedule II controlled substance. Also has a conviction from 2014 for illegally carrying a concealed firearm. The most recent conviction, the felony conviction, resulted in, quote, several months in prison. That's it. For larceny, felony common law robbery, felony possession of a Schedule II controlled substance. Old got out April 18th, and now, again, facing charges in a recent shooting there in Wilmington, North Carolina. Greer Hayes Old is our second deal of the day. Our good guy. Again, we already had one good guy with Anthony Calandro and the folks from Gun for Hire in Woodland Park, New Jersey. Talk about what happened when the floodwater started rising there in Woodland Park. But it was a bad weekend across, you know, much of the Northeast. A lot of rain, a lot of flooding. And NBC New York had the story of a couple of newlyweds who actually got stranded on top of their vehicle. Yeah, like just got married, and there they are on top of their vehicle, stuck. This was in Bogota, New Jersey. And the officers, as you can see, having to, you know, get out, stand on basically the roof of the car, help the bride in her wedding dress, crawl out of the sunroof, and get into that Humvee. Police there in Bogota, New Jersey said, "We hope the bride and groom had a great wedding day, and we wish nothing but the best for them." Well, I mean, I don't know if that counts as a great wedding day, but here's the thing. You're never, not that you're ever going to forget your wedding day anyway, but now you're really never going to forget your wedding day. When you actually, you know, got a ride, hopefully, to the hotel in the Humvee. Yeah, that's going to stay with you for a while. But to those officers there in Bogota, New Jersey, we thank you for being some of the many, many good guys out there. All right, still to come on the program, Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Later in the hour as well, Dave Koppel, Research Director at the Independence Institute. We'll talk about the plastic gun panic, not of 2018, which is going on right now. As a matter of fact, 3DPrintingIndustry.com. I didn't even know that website exists until today. But 3DPrintingIndustry.com with a story. Facebook bans 3D printed guns in newsfeed, Messenger, and Instagram. According to numerous sources, Facebook released a statement saying sharing instructions on how to print firearms using 3D printers is not allowed under our community standards. And so, links to sites that even host the files have been banned from Facebook. You can't even link to them. But I mean, we're not even talking about posting the files to Facebook. We're talking about writing a post that links to a site where those files will be available for download. Legally, I might add, be available for download. Facebook says, uh-uh. We'll talk about that again with Dave Koppel and how this panic compares to the plastic gun panic of 1986. That's coming up a little bit later on in the hour. We're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return, our friend Andrew Langer joins us, talking about the anti-NRA bias in academia. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Four liberals on the Supreme Court would take away your right to self-defense.
What does the Second Amendment mean to you?
Not the right of an individual to keep a gun next to his bed.
Four liberal justices oppose your right to self-defense. Four justices support your right to self-defense. President Trump chose Brett Kavanaugh to break the tie. Your right to self-defense depends on this vote. Tell your senator, defend our right to self-defense. Confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
My daughter came into the bedroom and she said, "Dad, there's a man in black tactical gear shooting up the Baptist church." Every one of those shots to me represented one of my neighbors, one of my friends. And I ran as fast as I could. Immediately, he came out of the church shooting at me. He hit the truck in front of me, hit the car behind me, hit the house behind me. And I hit him. He had an AR-15, but so did I. And it's not the gun, it's the heart. It's a matter of the heart. I'm not the bravest man in the world or anything, but I was here. I was here, and I could do something. And I had to do something.
The Bristol Motor Speedway holds all kinds of events all year round, including, as you can see behind me, monster trucks. But August 18th, it's the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. And over the next couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about the track, exploring the town of Bristol, and showing you why you need to be here in the stands for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. So we are about as high up as you can go here at the Bristol Motor Speedway right now. No more seats above us. And you can look down in the track, and you can see, even in the highest seats possible, the nosebleed section, this is an amazing view. And you've got the race that's going to unfold right before your very eyes. There's not a bad seat in the house here at the Bristol Motor Speedway. And even beyond the track, as the sun is setting on August 18th, you're able to look up. You'll be able to see those mountains off in the distance. The hills closer to the track will be filled with folks who have been camping out here all week, celebrating what makes America so great, celebrating the Bristol Night Race. I'm telling you, it is something that you actually have to see yourself to really understand what Bristol and the Night Race is all about. So I'm here in downtown Bristol, Virginia. I'm on the Virginia side. Right across the street from me is the state of Tennessee. This is a really unique location here in the United States. You've got this incredible border town, and the history of this, you know, it used to be back in the old days, you'd have the honky-tonks on the Tennessee side, you'd have the more staid establishments on the Virginia side. When they would shut down, everybody would go across the street and have a little bit more fun down the Tennessee side of town. Now, this is a pure slice of Americana right here, and I tell you what, you've got the historic buildings, you've got some incredibly old establishments, but you've also got new businesses that are opening up and reinvigorating the community on what seems like a weekly basis here. Not far away from me, we're going to head there next, is the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. There's all kinds of things to see and do in the Bristol area, so don't just come down Saturday morning for the Bristol Night Race and think that you're going to come home Sunday morning. Spend a couple of days here. Soak in the atmosphere. It is a beautiful part of the country and a fantastic place to spend a summer weekend. So just off of State Street, actually, you'll find the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. Make sure you take a couple of hours while you're down here for the night race and explore this incredible facility. If you love country music, if you love American history, there is so much to learn here. It's all interactive. And the museum actually is pretty new, only opened a couple of years ago, and it is already a crown jewel here in the Bristol area. Now, you know you don't want to see me waving this tiny little checkered flag. You want to see the real deal here in Bristol, right? And you can do so. We've told you how. NRARaceTix.com, August 18th, you're going to get the best price for a seat in the house there. 15% off for NRA members anywhere you want to sit.
and the Bristol Motor Speedway, August 18th, 2018. And I want to thank everybody here at the Bristol Motor Speedway for once again opening up their doors and their hearts. They're so generous. They are so nice here. It's going to be an amazing weekend. You don't want to miss it. Heck, it's going to be an amazing week. Forget the weekend. They've got events happening in the Tri-Cities area starting on Monday of race week. So go ahead, call the boss. I'm going to be off that week. I'll see you the week after the night race, and we will see you in Bristol for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race, August 18th. Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Thank you again for being a part of the program today. I was just watching video of that Jeep dealership there in North Jersey where the, as Anthony Calandra described it, the mudslide happened and the Jeeps went into the river and actually caused a dam to form, a dam of Jeeps that then caused the floodwaters to rise. That's no joke. That was crazy. Right now, Andrew Langer joins us from the Institute for Liberty with us. Andrew, how are you, sir?
It's always those damn Jeeps, Cam. Sorry.
I mean, hey, listen, one of us was going to make the dad joke, okay?
Of course.
I lobbed it up there for you. Glad to see you spike the ball.
Well, in my case, it's generally a badminton shuttlecock, but that's okay.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the program. You know, this is fascinating. We mentioned this on Friday's Cam and Company, but we didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. This new study out, gauging the bias of the Academy. And this is, you know, look, this is one study. I'm not saying this is a perfect snapshot of academia, but in the new book, Compromising Scholarship, Political Bias in Higher Education, George Yancey, who is a professor at University of North Texas, he did a survey of 435 sociology professors in the United States. So these are people who are already working as professors. And he asked, if you were able to learn of their political memberships, would this make you more or less likely to support their hire? And they gave him a number of groups, communist, Libertarian, Green Party, Republican, NRA, ACLU, Democrat, and then they threw in some non-political stuff like single parents, vegetarians. Of all of the political affiliations, Andrew, the NRA was ranked as the most likely to make a college professor say, I don't want them on staff. 41% conceding that it would damage an applicant's chance of getting hired.
Well, it's interesting. I actually have a bit of an anecdote, and the irony of my anecdote is that it has to do with a former professor at the University of North Texas, someone that I've known for a very long time, who was leaving UNT, was being hired by another university, and was literally – part of the irony is that he wound up marrying this person. But, you know, his application or his CV – because, of course, it's not an application – but his curriculum vitae – was rejected by one of the reviewing academics. Now, this is in a political science program at another university. And this person said specifically, oh, I don't want you to hire that conservative blankety blank from North Texas. They wound up hiring him anyway. And strangely enough, they're now married, but that's a whole different thing. But listen, this is something that has gone on. We know this. I find it interesting that this comes out of a sociology professor's study, because normally you see that kind of political bias, especially coming into political science programs. But I'll tell you, I have a family member who was involved in graduate school admissions. And this is 15, 20 years ago when I was looking at applying to graduate programs. And she said to me, make sure you remove any affiliation to conservative or center right or right leaning organizations or entities or political activities, because that will immediately make you suspect to any graduate admissions program. Listen, we know that this has been going on for a long time, that there has been a conscious effort on the part of the left to remove any aspect of free market limited government thought from the university environment. And we've seen this manifest itself in a whole host of ways. And let me just give you one other anecdote in all of this. You know, there's a reason why we are seeing fewer and fewer decent candidates for judgeships amongst conservatives. And that's because law schools, in response to the growth of organizations like the Federalist Society, which was itself an effort to make sure that conservative law students had a home on law school campuses. Well, there's been a concerted effort on the part of law school admissions to keep people, to keep conservatives out of law schools, right? You deny conservatives law degrees, you deny the conservative movement conservative lawyers a generation down the road.
So, again, you're talking about people who are applying as students, right?
Yes,
so they've
in this
passed
case,
their
students.
LSAT, they've, and they're applying, but if they're identifiable as a conservative,
yeah,
people are,
if they
are
work,
really,
if
I mean,
they
they're being told,
a,
no.
If they work for a Republican in Congress, if they were members of Turning Point USA or YAF, either version of YAF, Young Americans Foundation or Young Americans for Freedom, if they were the head of their college Republican chapter, keep that off of your application. I mean, obviously, unless you're applying to a conservative law school, of which there are only a handful. And again, this is not, you know, this is not everybody. This is not everywhere. This is not everything. But at least I've been told that this has been a concerted effort on the part of the left. And listen, in the same way the left has been responsible for trying to shut down conservative speech on campuses, the concept of deplatforming, right? This idea that, well, we're not violating your free speech. You still have the right to say what you want. You just can't say it here.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, listen, we have that in the gun control movement too, where the gun control activists say, we're not anti-gun. We just don't know why anybody would want to carry a firearm here or here or here or here or here or here. I mean, you know, and ultimately what it translates to is we don't think you should be able to carry a gun anywhere. It's so interesting to me, Andrew, that you've got, like, to me, there's almost that recognition of, okay, if we're honest with people, we're not going to see a lot of success. So we've got to dupe people into agreeing with us, right? So we've got to rebrand ourselves. We've got to call ourselves things that we're not. We've got to try to soften our message while still pushing these policies. Because if we were just blatantly honest, there'd be a whole lot more blowback and pushback to what it is we're trying to do.
Listen, I don't know if you're getting into it today with the antics that happened in Charlottesville or D.C., but there's certainly an element to that with the way that the media was covering these events. You know, the left needs the boogeyman of a white supremacist Trump movement. And when there isn't a white supremacist Trump movement, they don't cover that fact, right? The fact that only 30 people that showed up in D.C. should be some great celebration on the part of the American people, the fact that we don't have lots of Nazis. But on the other hand, you know, what the media isn't reporting then is the violence on the part of the Antifa crowd that's out there, right? The media goes apoplectic when people shout down or shout at Jim Acosta from CNN. They're silent when a CNN reporter gets brutally attacked in Charlottesville. Why? Because they need this narrative that the real threat is from some non-existent white supremacist movement in America and not from the very Antifa thugs that are being propagated by the left.
Yeah, in fact, I think I saw I can't tell you who wrote this, but I just saw this on go through my Twitter feed a couple minutes ago. Some reporter actually describing the Antifa individuals who were assaulting police officers as anti-violence protesters.
I mean, listen, I'm not someone who goes and starts shouting about fake news. What I'm more talking about are false narratives. And the false narrative that has been created, I mean, I know this is further afield than we want it to go, but this is what we're talking about here. That you know, they're shouting, the left is shouting about Trump trying to shut down platforms, or 43% of Republicans believe that the government ought to have an internet kill switch. Well, guess what? The Democrats have been talking about an internet kill switch in the form of net neutrality for years now, almost a decade, and yet there was never any sort of hue and cry. The reality is the only folks who are trying to shut down speech are folks on the left for the very reasons that you said, because they don't want to confront ideas. And they don't recognize the other side of it, which is the ideas that are the most abhorrent, right? Here's where I come back to. Let's keep this in mind, right? It is very easy for you to paint the broad brush and say that every conservative is a Nazi if you don't have actual Nazis to point to, right? If you shove all of the Nazis in America underground. You don't give them a platform to announce who they are to themselves and to the general public. They, you know, you don't let them hang a big neon sign around themselves, letting them know that they're a bunch of just horrible, horrible people. Well, then it's very easy for you to say, well, they're all Nazis, right? Because you know, you're not letting anybody speak. Whereas we know that you want to be able to confront those things. You want to hold them up to sunlight. You want to hold them up to ridicule. I mean, to me, the insane commentary was, and I'm not saying this admiringly, but where you have the Antifa protesters wearing masks and two and a half dozen Nazis who showed up in D.C. Insanely, they were proud to show their faces, which is, you know, was great for the rest of us because now we know who they are, and now we know those are the people you want to avoid in life. And unfortunately, we can't do that with the Antifa crowd because they all wear masks because they know that they're going to get exposed for the violent thugs that they are.
Yeah. And okay, so to that end, now, so let's say that Antifa's there. They're the violent ones. Then further down the spectrum are those, Andrew, who, you know, look, they've never taken a baseball bat to a protest. They've never thrown a rock at a police officer. But by God, if they see Sarah Sanders out eating dinner somewhere, they're going to give her a piece of their mind. They're going to yell at, you know, if they see Candace Owens having breakfast, they're going to yell and scream at them. I'm looking here. This is from Mass Live. I think this is the Worcester Telegram. The mayor of Somerville, Massachusetts, Joe Curtatone, says he plans to never again touch Sam Adams beer. Why? Because Jim Koch, the founder of Boston Beer Company, was one of 13 executives who had dinner with President Trump last week at the president's New Jersey golf resort.
Yeah.
And Mayor Curtatone said, I'll never drink Sam Adams beer again because that guy met with President Trump.
Well, but this is exactly why the left needs a boogeyman, right? This is why, you know, they're sort of holding this up and why they're sort of not allowing this sort of general scrutiny because they know that what this doesn't hold water. I mean, listen, this is where America gets into very dangerous territory because what should be happening is that the media should represent a check on this power. The media, now, and you do, obviously, NRA TV excluded, but the mainstream media, the big six, they should be the ones who are sort of out there shining the light of objective truth to all of this. And yet they have completely abdicated their responsibility. When NBC doesn't report that one of their reporters in Charlottesville is attacked by the Antifa mob, when somebody else, as you just said, is describing them as anti-violence protesters, this is where America gets into a very dangerous place. And we should be rightly worried. I mean, obviously it gives those of us, you know, like you and like some others who are engaging in good objective journalism or, you know, at least with a perspective, but at least shining the light on these things, it gives them that opportunity. But the reality is that, you know, we had an era of about 70 years where journalism was not advocacy, where it was objective reporting of facts. And we've lost that, and we've lost something major as a result of that.
How would you define that era, Andrew? Like, when do you say about 70 years? When do you think it began? When do you think it ended?
Well, I think it began after. I think it began just before World War II. I think it began as the sort of the muckraking, and I'm going to put muckraking and yellow journalism sort of into the same mold because the Sinclair Lewis's of the world and the William Randolph Hearst's of the world, they're two halves of the same coin. But when you see the rise of the great journalism schools that are teaching journalistic ethics, that are teaching sort of this idea of reporting just the who, what, why, when, where, and how. That started, I would say, around 1940 carried us to the end of the 20th century into the beginning of the 21st century. And then somehow it was gone. Probably sometime after George W. Bush got elected, and the media was horrified at what happened, rightly so, at the Constitution working in the way that it was supposed to. Then the Gulf War happened. And in the same way that America got divided after the 2000 election and into the 2004 election, you then had the rise of the great advocacy journalism once again, probably around 2006, just before Democrats took over Congress and then with Barack Obama's election in 2008.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, you can still find bias, you know, during the Reagan administration, and the 60s or 70s. But I think that you're right. I think that the election of George W. Bush in 2000, the stolen election of George W. Bush in 2000, right? I mean, that was the moment I think that this crystallized for a lot of folks in the media of, the Republic's going to die if we're not out there safeguarding it. And then, as you mentioned, the Iraq War in 2003, where I remember a lot of journalists here in the United States proclaiming themselves to be citizens of the world, Andrew. So it was inappropriate for them to wear, an American flag lapel pin as they reported on the Iraq War because they didn't want to be seen as taking sides, right?
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that. 15 years ago, we don't want to be seen as taking sides in the war that the United States is fighting. To now, if you're not seen as taking the side of the quote-unquote resistance, well, you can't be a journalist in good standing. I mean, you might still be able to work, but you're not gonna be, one of the celebrity journalists.
And then this circles us back into our initial point, the initial discussion, which is now the same thing goes back into academia. You can't be a good academician if you in any way support the conservative agenda, because the conservative agenda is all about what they term as fascism, which is a load of garbage. It's fascism as taught by Howard Zinn, who himself was, you know, essentially a fascist. For those of you who don't know, he wrote a book called The People's History of the United States, which, though Goodwill Hunting recommends it, it is an absolutely horrible through the looking glass look at American history. And so the point is that, you know, you have to be an academician who takes a stand in a certain regard, regardless of what objective reality tells you, regardless of what the research tells you, right? We're going to continue, though socialism has failed everywhere it's been tried, we're just going to say that that wasn't real socialism and that, in fact, it was due to American imperialism and the imperialism of racist white European men who have caused socialism's great demise throughout the world. And so we want to make sure we keep out anybody who's going to question that dogma, either at the academic level, at the professorial level, or below. With the worst, of course, as you pointed out, being someone who may be a theoretical NRA member. God forbid somebody would want to express being empowered to defend themselves in the most effective way possible.
Yeah. Andrew, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always good talking with you. Thank you so much, sir. And I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Andrew, you bet. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty with us here on Cam and Company. When we come back, Dave Kopel, Research Director at the Independence Institute. We'll talk about Dave's latest at the Avalik conspiracy, all about the plastic gun panic, not of 2018, but of 1986. How gun control lobbies nearly tricked Congress into banning millions of ordinary firearms, and they would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you meddling kids out there. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this. Well, we're spending some time with Butch Wyden from Cryptech. Butch, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Jen Dolphin from Prefix. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks.
And this is an absolute beautiful beast behind us right here. What are we looking at?
Well, this is a very special and unique project. This is the Cryptic Edition Dodge Ram Minotaur 1500, and it's a aftermarket vehicle that Prefix, Jan's company, has assembled in collaboration with Cryptic, the NRA, and several other great brands in the industry.
So this is, we as NRA members, we've got the opportunity to actually win this truck, right?
Well, there's going to be 150 of these trucks made, but this truck specifically, NRA members are going to be able to win, not just the truck, but an absolute amazing package of gear from great brands such as Weatherby, Leupold, Springfield Armory, Tenzing, Boyd Harness, Wiley X. There's about $25,000, Nosler ammo. There's about $25,000 of additional outdoor gear that's going to come along with this truck. And some lucky NRA winner is going to, our member is actually going to be able to win this truck that's well over $100,000.
Golly, okay. We're gonna talk more about how folks can win this, but first, Jan, let's talk about what's involved in this actual Dodge Ram Minotaur. What makes it so different and special?
Oh, absolutely. So, just to clarify, Prefix, we're the company that builds most of the concept cars and prototypes for the auto industry. But every couple of years, we have a little fun. We find a vehicle that we think we could make better or enhance, or we think there's a niche market for. And so the Minotaur truck was built as an awesome daily driver. It's kind of built as the as an equivalent engineering-wise like a Baja race truck. So on the highway, it's fantastic. But it's got 14 inches of suspension travel. It's the real deal. You can jump this thing, and it is just a beast.
Well, as somebody who actually owns a Dodge Ram, I can tell you that my Dodge Ram 1500 looks nothing like this Dodge Ram. I'm drooling right now. I'm having to actually keep my mouth closed.
That's perfect.
I mean, you talk about the suspension. What about under the hood? What are we looking at in terms of horsepower? Right. And
well, this comes with the 5.7 Hemi, which is a great motor for this truck. We do offer an optional supercharger. Like I said, we're building 150 of these. It's very low volume production. We love that exclusivity because that means that there's a good chance that the guys that own them are going to be the only guys in town that have them. And as Butch said, then there's one lucky guy who's going to get not only to win a Minotaur truck, but it's also going to be loaded with the prize package. So this
we're going to be able to start entering this lottery or this raffle here early March, and this is going to run for a year. Is that right?
That's my understanding. The NRA will really make an entire launch at the convention this year and open it up, and then all of the marketing and collateral start to go out and open up to NRA members. And then my understanding is that next year at the 2019 convention, they're going to pull a name out of a hat and somebody's going to win over $100,000 package.
I'm going to be entering. Are you going to be entering, Butch? Are you eligible? You're eligible, right?
I think so.
I mean, it's just a random drawing. All right.
If I wanted, I'd turn it back in. That's always cool when that happens.
And re-raffle it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a bold move for you, Butch. Right. I don't know that I'd be that generous, but this is amazing. And so tell me from your perspective, what was it like being involved in this project?
Well, it's kind of an interesting deal. When Prefix reached out to me and we started to have the discussion, hey, we'd like to talk to Cryptic about doing a Cryptic Edition Dodge Ram truck. You have to be like, first call's like, yeah, right, whatever, But then as we started the relationship and we started to understand what they were looking for and how this truck was a very, badass vehicle, and they felt that our brand nested well with the attitude of the truck.
He's being too nice. we knew we had done a lot of testing with these vehicles. We already had started selling them, and I was looking for something that we could do to really increase the excitement. And when we learned about Cryptic and their camo pattern, it was the attitude that this truck needed. It's exactly what it needed. So starting to work with Butch, kind of understanding the background of their company, Prefix is known, our tagline is excellence is expected, and we knew what we were putting into the vehicle. But to add this Cryptic attitude, very patriotic, very cutting edge, awesome, awesome look to the truck was just perfect. And we're getting the response because of it, for sure.
Well, for those who can't put down a deposit, we can buy a raffle ticket. NRABigTruckGiveaway.org. That's going to be the website that you need to go to enter this. Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. You can find our next guest on Twitter as well, at Dave Copel, Research Director at the Independence Institute and writer at the Vala Conspiracy as well. Dave, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. We finally have a Skype connection after multiple failed attempts.
Excellent.
Because I realized I needed to upgrade my Skype program.
It's good to actually see you. I appreciate you coming
Thank
on the
you.
Program. And this is fascinating. Over at Reason.com, host of the Vala Conspiracy, you have a piece on the 1986 plastic gun panic, tailor-made for terrorism. Washington Post says that a state sponsor of terrorism already attempted to obtain these firearms. A post-colonist warns that police vehemently oppose the introduction of plastic guns into our armed society. Newsweek predicting the NRA will face a member revolt for opposing legislation to ban plastic guns. Quote, this time the gun lobby may have shot itself in the foot. As you say, this is not, it could be ripped from the headlines today, but it's actually 30 years ago, between 1985 to 1988, you say those were the years of the first plastic gun panic. What was the first plastic gun that they were panicking about, Dave?
It was the Glock pistol, which today is a very common pistol. Everybody knows about it. In fact, there's even people who don't know much about guns might sometimes call a handgun a Glock, just because they think of that as some sort of generic name for a gun, for a handgun at least. And of course, a Glock cannot sneak through metal detectors. It's a very it's readily detectable because it's got in its the original Glock, the Glock 17, which was the gun at issue, has 19 ounces of metal in it. So it the claims that it could be passed through metal detectors were absolutely false. But plastic guns, so-called, were new. I mean, you have the Remington Nylon 66 back from 1959 that had a plastic stock, but the idea of a plastic handgun was something that the gun ban lobbies were very effective at using to terrify the American public and a good share of Congress.
You know, and again, I mean, this speaks to something we were actually talking about earlier on the program. Gun control advocates love to proclaim that the gun lobby scares Americans into becoming gun owners, right? That they operate via fear. That's exactly what the gun control activists do. I mean, 30 years ago, as you know, and as you point out, look, these gun control activists, they knew that, a Glock wasn't a undetectable plastic firearm, that there was a plenty of metal there, but it served their purposes to have the American public freaked out about the idea of a plastic firearm. So why educate Americans if it's going to make them less freaked out when, if you're a gun control advocate, you want them more freaked out?
Of course. And that as you say, that's the whole modus operandi of the gun ban lobbies. I think it's true to say the NRA, some of its public communications, does involve people responding to fear, fear that they're going to confiscate your guns, which they've already started doing in New York City and other jurisdictions, and also fear of crime in general, which is something a reasonable, prudent person would be concerned about. I mean, you don't accuse the people who say you should have a fire extinguisher in your home of fomenting fear about fires. It's just a sensible thing to do to have the tools to keep your family safe, which for every family should include a fire extinguisher. And I think for every family that's responsible enough to own a gun should at least include consideration of that. But then on the other side, the gun ban lobbies have nothing. You know, they're not like, they don't have NRA shooting sports or hunting or, target shooting or, safety training or any kind of sort of wholesome activities that they talk about. They're 100% fear all the time. And their problem is that in the 60s and early 70s, they were doing okay on, we got to get everybody afraid of handguns. But then it turned out that didn't work out too well. And when they tried handgun ban referenda, they got crushed in places like Massachusetts and in California. And so then they, I think they've realized, okay, we can't scare Americans about guns in general, but we can scare them about guns they don't know about or haven't heard about. And at the time, the Glock was the perfect vehicle for that.
Absolutely. And so ultimately we saw legislation introduced, as you write about, Howard Metzenbaum, in 1987, introducing legislation to outlaw all firearms that contained less than 8.5 ounces of steel, because supposedly they could pass through metal detectors. And you point out as well, the devil's always in the details here with the gun control legislation. The requirement for 8.5 ounces of steel, you said that this would not have actually applied to the Glock because that had 19 ounces of steel, but there were plenty of other handguns that would have been banned outright if this legislation had actually become law.
Absolutely. There were tens of thousands at least of antique guns that had less than that amount of steel. And of course, as you say, the question of steel versus metal was an extremely important one because there are guns that are made with alloys that have some steel, but they're not all steel. And so for example, the Beretta 950, which is a 25 ACP small handgun, has zero plastic in it. Maybe you could put on plastic grips in the aftermarket or something, but other than that, it's all metal. And weighs over 8.5 ounces, but it didn't have, it had less than that amount of pure steel. So that would have been banned. And likewise, the Raven pistol, which was a inexpensive, small handgun, 13 ounces of metal, but only 3.5 ounces of pure steel.
So that's introduced by Senator Metzenbaum. And I mean, honestly, Dave, I didn't realize how close this was. December of that year, you say he tried to attach his legislation to a bill to increase aid to veterans. And again, try to attach an unpopular proposal, or at least a controversial proposal, to a piece of popular legislation. If you can get that attached, then chances are, aha, we're going to get this bill signed into law. That vote fell short 44 to 47. I mean, that close to getting attached to that that bill. But even after that, Metzenbaum wasn't done. What did he do after his first attempt to attach this legislation to a bill failed?
Well, of course, he kept on trying. But the fortunate thing was that NRA and other civil rights organizations were successful enough in educating Congress about this that eventually Congress worked out a compromise and passed a bill which is currently law, 18 U.S. Code 922, I think, subsection P, which says from now on, any firearm that's manufactured has to have at least 3.7 ounces of steel in it. And I guess the way that was, and that steel has to be in the profile of a handgun. And as written, it didn't ban anything, and has never banned anything since then. So the gun ban lobbies got to say, well, we actually passed something, which was a big accomplishment for them. And the civil rights people got to say, well, we prevented any guns from being banned, which was a big accomplishment for them.
I'm talking to you with the Dave Koppel, Research Director of the Independence Institute. An interesting sort of postscript to that, 1990, the movie Die Hard 2 comes out. And of course, we are introduced to the fictional Glock 7, the all-porcelain gun made in Germany that doesn't show up on airport X-ray machines. So, I mean, you know, it's fascinating.
Like, and it costs more than a month's salary.
Exactly. Yes, it costs more than what you make in a month. I mean, you know, when Hollywood sort of latched on to that idea of the undetectable firearms, you know, did that how much damage did that do in the just, you know, to the American culture, to the average non-gun owner who doesn't know a lot about these issues, but now has had, you know, literally decades of this fear mongering sort of imprinted on them from the press and from, you know, entertainment sources.
Well, that's another accomplishment of the anti-gun lobbies. Back in the 90s, handgun control, as they called themselves at the time, worked closely with Hollywood and television producers to get anti-gun themes inserted into movies and TV programs. And they continue that now. The Bloomberg lobby has also taken that up. And that's sort of what diplomats call soft power. It's not something that necessarily directly leads to legislation, but it softens up the mind of the people who don't know any better. I remember back in 1992 or 93, one of the reasons Virginia passed its ban on its one gun a month law, which I think has been repealed since then, one handgun a month, was because there was a Batman comic book in which the bad guys from Gotham City, which means New York City, went to Virginia to buy guns. And so the comic book was an intentional advertisement for what the gun rationing law that was being pushed at the time. So that popular culture absolutely has an effect. As Andrew Breitbart said, politics is downstream of culture.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, as we're talking, Dave, I just saw this story come across from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Broward Library suspend printer use over 3D gun concerns. So in Broward County, Florida, they're just no more can you use the 3D printers at the public library because you might possibly download these files and print off a 3D gun. So now they're just putting an end to all 3D printer use. The plastic gun panic of 1986 may have subsided, but the plastic gun panic of 2018, I think, is still going pretty strong.
Everything that's old is new again. That was the view of the Enlightenment in the 1700s or 1800s that all this kind of stuff that we're seeing today. You can look back in Greek and Roman history and see it going on back on then. John Adams once wrote that when he was reading Greek history, he felt like he was reading the history of his own times.
There you go. Dave Copel, thank you as always, sir, for coming on the program. It's so good talking to you today and great seeing you.
Thank you. Good to see you too.
You bet. We'll do this again very soon. Dave Copel with us here on Cam and Company. This is the best part of the story from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. The 3D printers have been available at Broward Libraries for about 4 years, according to Broward Library Director Kelvin Watson. However, Watson said library visitors have not been able to do the printing on their own, but would submit their request to the library staff who did the actual printing. So for 4 years, by the way, these plans have been available for several years now online. Yeah. So somebody could have gained access 3 years ago, but whatever. Even back then, you've not actually been able to print stuff out yourself. You have to go to the librarian and say, can you print this for me on the 3D printer? And even with that safeguard in place, Watson says, I'm going to be a little more cautious. And so for now, there will be no 3D printing. Damon Whitley is a resident of Oakland Park. He had planned to take his daughters to a course on how the printers operate on Saturday, but was informed the classes were canceled because the use of the 3D printers was being suspended. Whitney says, I can't understand their knee-jerk reaction. He says, it's not the right approach. The library system should talk to their vendors that supply the 3D printers so that it's foolproof and no one can use the printer unless it's been submitted and approved by the library. I think there's a lot of overreaction going on here, but, they're doing something. And as we know, anti-gun politicians, even anti-gun officials, those unelected officials, they love to be able to say that they're doing something. That has to be something that works. Just has to be something that can get them in front of the cameras, something that'll give them a soundbite, something that they can do to let their audience know that they care. All right, we only have a few seconds left here on the program. Quick programming note, I will be off tomorrow. John Pop and Cameron Gray will be sitting in. Probably, fingers crossed, we'll be back on Wednesday dealing with some family stuff. Hopefully, I'll be back on Wednesday. If not, I promise I'll be back soon. In the meantime, enjoy John, enjoy Cameron, enjoy Cam and Company. Be safe, have fun. We'll see you here soon with more Cam and Company right here on NRA TV.